You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Patricia Axelrod, who is a military scientist for peace and the director of the Desert Storm think tank and All Veterans Advocate, a project dedicated to analyzing and reducing the impacts and consequences of war to civilians and soldiers alike. She's testified before presidential advisory committees on issues of Persian Gulf illness and other veteran health issues, and her work has been incorporated into congressional research projects as well as GAO efforts. She is in Illinois at the moment and has conducted in-theater bomb damage assessment post-Desert Storm throughout Iraq, where she was held captive by the Hussein government, as well as from Budapest to Kosovo following American warfare against Kosovo. Her work on behalf of veterans serves to obtain medical treatment for individual sick and dying veterans otherwise deprived of care by the VA, and her long-term experience battling with the VA leads her to believe that the VA healthcare system is corrupt and broken beyond repair and therefore should be abolished and replaced with Medicare and or another civilian healthcare system. Patricia Axelrod, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David, and I'm pleased to be here. Very timely right now in light of the fact, of course, that we now have yet another Trump move against veterans and against soldiers as it regards his effort to ban transgender soldiers and veterans possibly from care.
I love the idea of abolishing the VA and replacing it with Medicare for All, because I love the idea of creating Medicare for All and creating universal benefits for everyone. Is this something you've been working on proposals for? Is there any movement on such a transformation in Washington?
Actually, there is a movement, although it's a rather quiet movement, I might add. It hasn't made a lot of press. Let me inform your listeners that as we speak today, and by the end of 2018, there will be 9.3 million veterans, a great percentage of which will be requiring and accessing the VA. And let me tell you that I came to this opinion via a long-term battle with the VA. As a veteran advocate, I not only research and write about veteran issues, I also, on a one-on-one basis, fight for health care and go nose to nose with VA doctors and medical practitioners in order to obtain medical care for sick and dying veterans who would otherwise be deprived of medical care. And we're talking about veterans who, unfortunately, in many instances are 100% disabled and still have not received their benefits for service-connected disability. We're talking about veterans who are browbeaten, who are reduced to suicide. I remind your listeners, if you're not aware of this, that more than one veteran per hour kills him or herself. These are the suicide rates amongst veterans. This is what we know to be true, at least one veteran per hour. I can assure you, in my estimation, that's even higher. That level of suicidal action is even higher. So as a consequence of battling with the VA, going up against the medical directors of the VA, battling it out with the secretaries of the VA, I can assure you, in my opinion, it is so broken, the system is so corrupt, the persons working there, the VA personnel, are so beaten down themselves. And on top of which, let me tell you this, VA medical personnel and directors, medical directors and administrative directors are incentivized to deny care. They're financially incentivized to deny care. This is a dirty, ugly secret that people are not cognizant of. But this is, in some great measure, why veterans are routinely denied care. Because any money that is derived from denying care essentially winds up in the pockets of the upper echelon of the VA, inclusive of medical directors and even medical personnel on the ground. So with that said, if they are incentivized to deny care, if they are, in fact, the personnel, the medical personnel, and the other personnel are so browbeaten and so tired as a consequence of veterans who are standing there demanding care, hoping for care, begging for care, doing their best to get care, and then, of course, become frustrated when they don't receive adequate care. Therefore, of course, they vent against the medical personnel, who in turn turn it around and vent against the VA. It is a vicious cycle and circle that will never be corrected and needs to be replaced. And I am surely totally aware of this as a consequence of the fact that, as I said to you, in my experience, and after complaining, I might add, to congressional VA committees and so forth, there are those at the congressional level that are supportive of abolishing this. But if you will take note of the latest statement by David Shulkin, the new VA secretary, he has said full well that the VA will never be privatized. They will never relinquish their turf. The VA will not be abolished. The healthcare system will not be abolished.
It's an interesting problem, Patricia Axelrod, because advocates for single-payer healthcare or Medicare for All or universal system that cuts out the private health insurance companies, that unique corrupt creation of the United States, view government coverage of health costs as preferable. But here you're pointing to a government health coverage system as being hopelessly corrupt. How does the VA differ from what Medicare for All would be?
Well, Medicare for All has a means test, as you know. And once one qualifies for Medicare, talking about Medicare in the real term, but Medicare for All, let me first address the issue of Medicare, Medicaid versus the VA. When one qualifies for Medicaid, one then can actually go to any physician who will accept Medicaid and therefore receive care. And interestingly enough, those costs are considered to be lower. Health care costs are considered to be lower for Medicaid than they are for the VA. Now, as far as universal health care is concerned, Medicaid for All, I would tell you that as privately that I believe in this for all civilian and veteran populations. And what it would do is cut out the middle person. Now, the VA has something called a choice program, which allows for veterans to access civilian health care if allegedly there is no health care, VA health care, available to them. And I say allegedly, this is, in fact, the mandate for the choice program. And this choice program came about as a consequence of the 2014 hearing, whereupon people began to learn of the horrific wait time that veterans experienced, and also the health care that they were receiving, which was resulting in a lack of health care and subsequent unnecessary deaths. therefore, in 2014, something called a choice program came to be, and it is a, it should allow a veteran to access civilian health care if and when there is no VA physician who can tend to their needs, if there is a specialty, for instance, that the VA does not have at that particular facility, or if they've had to wait overly long. The bottom line, though, is that this choice program is an extraordinary failure as well, because it is subject to all of the failings of the VA, because any soldier or veteran who accesses the choice program must go through the VA in order to obtain this, and therefore the bureaucracy of it all holds them up. And the same corruption that every other veteran is subject to under the VA comes into play via the choice program. So the choice program is an entire farce as well. Now, vis-a-vis universal health care, I think it's perfectly, I'll be frank if you'll be earnest, right, David? I am not fully informed about the adequacies and or alleged failings of universal health care. I do know, as an aside, that this is something that is practiced in the UK, also in Germany, and also in Canada. And I've been the recipient of this health care in these nations, and I can assure you that I did not encounter anywhere near the problems that I might have had in the United States, and the health care was sufficient. So certainly I am a proponent of universal health care, but I can't really discuss that, David, and wouldn't want to lead you astray, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I like to think it would have a smaller bureaucracy than the VA, because it would not be providing health care, just health coverage, and because it would be universal and no means tests, et cetera. But the possibilities for corruption, I think, are always endless. You mentioned suicides, Patricia, and I wonder to what extent you think the high rate of suicides in U.S. troops and veterans is preventable by better health care.
Oh, I can assure you from dealing with veterans, I do receive phone calls from veterans who are ready to kill themselves. I have a veteran who has a noose hanging in her closet as she waits for the time to strike. The bottom line is that despite the one thing the VA is good at is propaganda. The one thing they're good at is PR. That's the one thing they're good at. Because they are assuring you, if you watch television, if you watch mainstream television, they are now reaching out to veterans and they're telling, I've seen public comments or public notices where veterans are encouraged to call if they're experiencing suicidal ideation being that they're at that point where they're planning to do it. They've got everything ready to go. Maybe they've got their pills out. Maybe they've got the noose out. Maybe they've got their blade out to cut their throat. And just before that time, they are expected to pick up the phone and call the same VA which is responsible for them reaching this point. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is something that is ongoingly contributing to the suicidal rate of veterans. And because the military as a whole is not properly addressing this issue, because they are loath to acknowledge that in reality, going to war, these young people, many of whom are between the ages of 17 and 24, they think of war as a computer game. They have no idea of the realities of war. They have no idea that they're going to be killing people. The rules of engagement in warfare, modern warfare, U.S. modern warfare, involve things like running over children if, in fact, with tanks and or trucks, if, in fact, let's say a young kid jumps out in front of a military convoy, you don't stop. You run that child over. These rules of engagement, in fact, lead to something called moral injury. And moral injury, coupled to the fact that these veterans have been led to believe that the VA is there for them, that it will tend to their needs, that it will serve them, coupled to this extraordinary frustration and the fact that they're not getting adequate care. I know myself that I have called on behalf of veterans to save them however I can. I do this generally with a three-way conversation. I'll have the veteran on the line, I'll bring the VA in, and I will ask, beg, cajole, plead, demand to get health care for this veteran, to get mental health care for this veteran. And in fact, it's not forthcoming. I know this myself. I have lost veterans. I have had veterans for whom I have cared kill themselves. So I can assure you that this is an issue that is not going away. Afghanistan, it is my understanding, there was an announcement today that the mineral wealth of Afghanistan is now something in excess of $1 trillion. I can assure you that tempted by that mineral wealth, the United States is not pulling out of Afghanistan. They're going to go in there and, in fact, gain that, grab that, those natural resources if they can. These young people are dying on behalf of corporate entities that become wealthier and wealthier. These young people are dying for oil. They're dying for mineral resources. In my estimation, a human being, a young man or woman, is worth far more than any amount of natural resources, of oil, mineral wealth, whatever it might be, that the United States can gain by entering into war. And I will tell you this, that with that said, bear in mind that Donald Trump, who calls himself a, quote, military man, a man who never served, I might add, himself, and who denigrated, I might add, Senator McCain by going so far as to say that he prefers to have his heroes, quote, dead, not alive, but dead. Trump, and I cannot use the term President Trump. I'm sorry. I find that offensive. Trump is, in fact, doing his best to recruit at least 60,000 more soldiers into the U.S. Army. And there is an extraordinary effort underway right here and now, even as we speak, to recruit more soldiers. The Army is scheduled to spend $300 million on bonuses and ads to get 6,000 more recruits, for instance. And so with that said, as the various branches of the military do their best to seduce these young people, in many cases going into high schools and making them promises of great heroics and great, promising them, for instance, that they're going to have money for college, promising them bonuses that never materialize, promising them the moon and giving them cheese, essentially, rotten cheese. I can assure you that these issues will become more significant as time wears on.
Patricia, you talked about PTSD and about moral injury. There's a third phenomenon that I've run into in numerous veterans in recent years, which is brain injury from explosions.
Traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
TBI, yeah. That is an issue that is poorly understood. Perhaps you folks, your listeners, know this, or perhaps you don't. You know, we know more about outer space than we do the human brain and its function thereof. So TBI, or traumatic brain injury, is an issue that affects veterans physically and mentally, intellectually, and obviously impacts their future. TBI is routinely experienced in the battlefield as a consequence of modern warfare, so-called modern warfare, where American soldiers mount extraordinary firepower, inclusive of the use of so-called depleted uranium, which I would refer to rather as radioactive weaponry. So, the use of explosive devices, which bring about shock and awe, unfortunately, to our veterans, and consequently, our soldiers are experiencing what has now become known as traumatic brain injury, TBI. Another factor that's extraordinarily important is the use of so-called depleted uranium, and I think it's vital to qualify that depleted uranium, or what I would refer to as radioactive weaponry, is manufactured from actual nuclear waste. And when, in fact, a projectile, we'll call it DU right now, when a projectile impacts its target, what happens is that this dust, this radioactive dust, derived from the use of this class of weaponry, is thereafter inhaled by all civilians and veterans. And the veterans, naturally inhaling radioactive dust, and this is an alpha emitter, I might add, alpha emitter, so it is akin to radon. This radioactive material, this dust, these particles are akin to the inhalation of radon, and those who are cognizant of radon may know that in the past, and of course the EPA today, who knows what it will do, but in the past, the EPA made the statement that there was no safe level of exposure to radon. The same thing is true with this radioactive weaponry, and these people inhale it, and it is now lodged in the lungs and is traveling through the bloodstream. And just as in the past, soldiers and veterans suffered from the consequences of Agent Orange as a consequence of the fact, of course, that the military would not acknowledge the health impacts and effects of Agent Orange. So it is true with the use of this particular class of weaponry, and this is deployed broadly throughout any so-called hotspot that U.S. forces are exposed to.
I know that most nations don't use DU weapons, and many consider them illegal. But I was disappointed that it was not included in the new treaty banning nuclear weapons. There's no inclusion of.
Yeah, David, I hate to correct you, my dear. And self-praise is no recommendation, but I've been following this issue for many years. As an aside, there was indeed an effort within the UN to ban the use of this class of weaponry. But in fact, so-called DU is widely deployed amongst U.S. allies, inclusive of Israel, I might add. It was first deployed, as a matter of fact, in the Seven-Day War of Israel against Egypt. And it is an extraordinarily effective tank killer and an extraordinarily effective and powerful weapon of choice, so that it's being deployed in 20-millimeter rounds. It is being deployed in artillery. It is broadly deployed throughout U.S. forces, as well as unfortunately, many of our allies. Now, they may not acknowledge the use of this, but I can assure you it leaves behind a signature that is noticeable. And as an aside, just as an aside, in my assessment of bomb damage assessments from Kosovo to Yugoslavia, from Budapest to Kosovo, I took a Geiger counter and went from bomb site to bomb site and essentially crawled around from bomb site to bomb site with a specifically calibrated Geiger counter that would detect alpha emissions. And in fact, there was certainly a signature that was produced, a radioactive signature that was produced. The issue with so-called depleted uranium is, in fact, number one, the use of that term, which neutralizes its lethality. And so, therefore, those who are cognizant of it, because they hear this term, quote, depleted uranium, I'm talking about civilians, not we who are engaged in this effort, but the use of the military speak, weapons speak, of so-called the term depleted uranium, ostensibly neutralizes the lethality of this. So, indeed, this coupled to the fact that I'm sure your listeners are wholly cognizant of the fact that the radioactive waste is a big problem.
It is, Patricia. We've got less than a minute left. I do still suffer under the misimpression that most countries aren't using it, and that of the 130 or so countries that are seeking to ban nuclear weapons, most of those are not using DU. Am I wrong in that?
I would say, with all due respect, you are wrong. Those combatant countries, such as the U.K., such as any of the other allies.
The U.K. is not seeking to ban nuclear weapons, sadly. I wish it were.
No, exactly. And that's what we want to think about. I mean, there may be many nations that are working to ban nuclear weapons or are supportive of that. This does not mean even necessarily that those same countries are indeed engaged in addressing the issue of depleted uranium or radioactive weaponry, because they're not wholly cognizant of the lethality and the impact and effect that it has upon soldiers and civilians alike, leaving behind, I might add, not only sickened soldiers and veterans, but thousands upon thousands of civilians who are also suffering the consequences.
Thank you, Patricia Axelrod, for the work you're doing, for informing us and stimulating ideas and proposals. We will keep in touch. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, I thank you so much for having me, and may I wish everyone, all of your listeners, all the best. May I give my number? 775-412-5980. Veterans in need, family members concerned about veteran health, give me a call. I stand by, willing and ready to assist you.
Thanks, Patricia.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, talking to reporters on Air Force One last month, Donald Trump said, quote, Dakota Access takes it to the Pacific. Who do they compete with? Russia, close quote. Every word of that is nonsense, or as Politico graciously put it, it was not immediately clear what Trump meant. Given that the Dakota Access Pipeline goes nowhere near the Pacific, and oil is an international market. But while Trump is wrong out loud, corporate media are tacitly wrong in their evident belief, if coverage is guide, that the fight over the pipeline is over. We'll get an update on a struggle that's very much alive from Candy Mossett, organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Also on the show, the fact that Sinclair Broadcasting Group's bid to take over Tribune Media would create a behemoth with control of TV stations reaching 72% of the country's households might be the preeminent reason to oppose that deal, but it isn't the only one. We'll talk through the problems with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press. That's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Listeners may recall photographs of Native American people on horses facing masses of law enforcement in riot gear and tanks near Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. These powerful images seem to symbolize the fight of indigenous communities and others against a pipeline carrying fracked oil from the Bakken fields some 1,000 miles into Illinois, crossing the Missouri River that serves as a life source for the Standing Rock and others in the region. But fights have many fronts, some less visible than others. And as activists know, struggles don't end when media lose interest. The No Dapple fight may not be in your newsfeed anymore. That doesn't mean it's over. Far from it. Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. She joins us now by phone from North Dakota. Welcome back to Counterspin, Candy Mossett.
Thank you. It's good to be back here.
Well, when we spoke with you last September, the resistance of the Standing Rock Sioux and other indigenous communities against the Dakota Access Pipeline had yet to make the broadcast nightly news. The struggle did get media attention after that, not always thoughtful attention, but some attention. But now again, after the pipeline's completion, it would appear that some of the press, anyway, think that the struggle at Standing Rock is not just over, but lost. What would you like people to understand about what's happening right now?
I really hope that people understand that what happened at Standing Rock, the importance of it can't be undermined in any way, shape, or form, because it was absolutely not a loss, nor is it over. We have a lot of things that are going on right now in reference to the Dakota Access Pipeline. We've been lifting up the struggles that have already occurred. There have been 3 leaks in that pipeline since it has begun operations. There were 2 in North Dakota and 1 that you might have heard of, a bigger one in South Dakota. We also have the North Dakota Public Service Commission, which was working with Dakota Access at the time. They have to, you know, put all these permits out and stuff when they do the whole process of having a pipeline. Well, they're actually preparing a case right now. One next Thursday, they are going to court against Dakota Access for at least 4 major violations that this company made. That was failure to notify the commission of their route changes. They had tree removal violations. They did separation of topsoil from subsoil, and those were violations. And they also had a violation of the company's spill prevention plan. So that case happening next week carries different fines and different things, negative things against the company that can come along with it. And this is at a time when we have a judge, Judge Boasberg, who ordered that, yes, they did mess up and there needs to be a further environmental review done. And he came up with that in June. So that was kind of another victory for us in the court case that still continues on. Now we're pushing this judge to decide to shut down the operations during that environmental review, which can take anywhere from 1 to 3 years to complete. They also do not have a plan for wastewater or for spills or anything like that. And so it's really important that people understand all of these processes are in play, and we're still looking at the possibility of shutting down the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Well, that's very exciting and not necessarily what I would guess from coverage, because one sort of got the sense that, well, Trump came in and green-lighted everything, and that's not the case. I mean, he may have tried to, but it
right.
sounds as though it hasn't won the day yet at all.
At all. In fact, he overstepped his authority in many regards to that particular signature that he put down, which is why it's coming out now. The reason why it's taking so long is because court processes operate that way. We don't expect the judge to make this decision until September for shutting down the pipeline while they do an environmental review. But as the Public Service Commission comes forward with their case here in North Dakota to show the environmental violations and different regulations that this company violated, the case is stronger and stronger to shut down this pipeline while this review actually happens. The thing is that it's all being done backwards because of this rushed, get it done, you know, get the pipeline in the ground nature. And it should call to attention to more people that laws were violated, laws were broken. Even though we're not in the camp anymore, we're still fighting for our constitutional rights to uphold laws.
Well, and speaking of that and of courts, more than 800 people were arrested during the mm-hmm. resistance. And of course, whatever else happens, those people are still personally, you know, very much in danger. What can we say about the situation of folks who are fighting for their right to have stood up against this?
It's kind of going on a case-by-case mm-hmm. basis right now, but we are seeing a lot of wins in the sector of all these people that are going to court. The thing is that it's costing folks money to go back and forth and to keep canceling court dates and making people go back and just really making people's lives miserable that were arrested simply for saying, we don't want this, we never did want it, water is life. So it is definitely a situation where the lawyers, the Water Protector Legal Collective, are working that we can actually drop all of the cases. And this is coming out from investigative reviews that are being done against Tiger Swan, against intelligence gathering sources here in North Dakota. A lot of behind the scenes information around just how crooked, I would say, mm-hmm. the system was when it came to the Standing Rock Water Protectors is all coming out now in investigations. So that's actually a really good thing for us. We're seeing a lot happening, and the Water Protector Legal Collective is a place that people can go. It's waterprotectorlegal.org. So you can actually donate to the cause, to the fight, to help out this 800 arrestees. You can look at their names. You can figure out who's all still fighting in the court and specifically donate to individuals. So it's a really good thing to continue to help this fight at Standing Rock, that it continues on. Like you said, the media might not be covering it because people aren't getting shot at, but we're very much still in the battle.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about Tiger Swan, because that has been one of the most alarming aspects, was Energy Transfer Partner, that's the DAPL parent company, hiring Tiger Swan, this group founded by retired members of a U.S. military counterterrorism unit, Delta Force. And the website The Intercept got some internal documents showing that Tiger Swan likened pipeline opponents to jihadists and described them as an ideologically driven insurgency with a strong religious component, on which we might have many notes, but I would say also another document said, quote, while we can expect to see the continued spread of the anti-DAPL diaspora, aggressive intelligence preparation of the battlefield and active coordination between intelligence and security elements are now a proven method of defeating pipeline insurgencies, close quote. Now, this is the group that's working hand in glove with law enforcement. So we see the state and private corporations acting as one, and then you have a situation where if you have a fight with a company, you're basically labeled a terrorist. And I know mm-hmm. that this isn't unique, but it just seems to me like whether DAPL is your fight or any other fight, you have to see the danger of what's happening there.
That's exactly right, and that is why Dakota Access Pipeline and this fight against it is really historic. We stood up against these things that are happening anyways. and are bringing it to the national attention and the national spotlight. Look, if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere to anybody. Privacy is, you know, being hacked into. People aren't allowed to exercise our constitutional rights in the United States that we say are so important. And we're showing that the industry has so much power and so much control. But at the same time, regardless of what Tiger Swan says in their own reports, we know that we're winning because they recently applied for a permit to operate in Louisiana. Now, a lot of people don't know that the Bayou Bridge Pipeline is a fight we're fighting as well, because it will connect to the Dakota Access Pipeline in Illinois. And that is how our country is moving this Bakken oil out of the country. We don't get any of the oil being extracted here. But that permit that Tiger Swan applied for in Louisiana was denied by the state of Louisiana because of their actions in North Dakota. Now, had we not been there and shown up and fought back against this company, they might still have free reign to go wherever. So you see, it's so important to look at the big picture and long term of these fights and these battles, and not be afraid to deal with those, you know, short term consequences that are really horrific. It was really like bad for us. I was in the camp for 7 months fighting because of this oil that's coming from my own homeland. I'm like sitting here at my mom's house in Newtown right now, and getting ready to do a toxic tour and getting ready to show people that the extraction still exists here in the Bakken for this oil that's going through Dakota Access. The fight doesn't end until we stop it at the source and keep these fossil fuel projects from happening. We say keep it in the ground, keep the oil in the ground. And that's what we're continuing to fight to do.
Well, and I would only add, in terms of media, keeping it in the ground is the scientific consensus. It's not a fringe idea. It's a scientific right. consensus that if we want to avoid, besides the immediate impacts even, which are catastrophic enough, the global impacts of not leaving fossil fuels in the ground are understood. And so I would hope that media coverage would always begin and end with that fact.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's what we're working for. And we just need more and more people to wake up and have the will to say, you know what, I'm going to make a slight change in my life today. Because a lot of times the blame gets placed on the individuals. Well, you use this, you use that. This is how you live. We have to really focus on placing the blame where it squarely belongs, which is on the industry and the corporations that are making products that they don't give us any other choices. Why is it that in the United States of America, we don't have an entire fleet of only solar-powered plug-in hybrid vehicles? Why are gas guzzlers even still made? It's the system that has this negative feedback loop, and the system needs to be changed. And people like myself, like all of the listeners, need to be given the options and choices that already exist. We're just not being told about them or given access to them.
Well, thank you so much, Candy Mossett. We've been speaking with Candy Mossett, an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. It sounds as though the hope that people placed in the peaceful resistance at Standing Rock, that hope is still alive.
Hope is alive. We never, ever, ever take our hope from us. And that's the most important and powerful thing that came out of Standing Rock. That fire that burned that whole time is still burning in all of our hearts. And it will continue to do so until we win.
Candy Mossett is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. They're online at ienearth.org. Candy Mossett, thank you so much for joining us again on Counterspin.
Matsigirad, thank you.
Sinclair Broadcasting Group is already the largest owner of television stations around the country, with some 173. But it's looking to increase that dominance by taking over Tribune Media, which owns stations in key markets like New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. The deal would mean Sinclair would own more than 220 stations, reaching some 72% of U.S. TV households. Time was, a single company controlling so much would raise alarms by itself, especially in a society that claims to value competition. But now, critics like Jack Schaefer say complaints about super-concentrated media ownership reek of stupidity. Because after all, there's Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. No matter that vast numbers of Americans rely on local news as a primary way of learning about the world, or that the existence of multiple sectors is not an argument for a lack of diversity in one sector. It's as if to say, it's okay that school textbooks are biased, because after all, there are cookbooks and comic books, too. But if any company dominating the country's local news would be worrisome, those worries are compounded when it comes to Sinclair. Because of that company's pronounced ideological bent, their track record, and the means by which they appear to be getting their way. Here to fill us in on the situation is Craig Aaron. He's president of the group Free Press. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, perhaps before we talk about Sinclair becoming more powerful, we talk about what they've done with the power they already have. What should we know about this company?
Well, I think what you need to know about Sinclair is this is, first of all, a huge company. They already own more individual local television stations than any other company in the country. They're already at the supposed national cap for how many stations one company should be allowed to own. But Sinclair, in particular, has used their network to both push cookie-cutter content, but that content with a very, very conservative slant. This is a company with a very strong ideological agenda, and they push to all of their affiliates a series of conservative commentators who are must-runs for all those stations. They have to put them on the air. And they have a long history of using their media power to push a conservative agenda and especially a Republican Party agenda. You know, this goes back at least as far as their decision to run the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth video that was an attack, essentially a feature-length attack ad on John Kerry when he was running for president. And there are numerous instances since then where they have used the public airwaves to push a very, very partisan agenda.
Well, yeah, the familiar argument from some quarters is that Sinclair's in-your-face right-wing views actually represent an influx of diversity in media. That relies on a rarely examined assumption that all other media represent an equally staunch liberalism that needs countering, and then a never-explained assumption that liberalism means, you know, believing Muslims or gay people have human rights. Schaefer actually offers as an example of the kind of unique viewpoint that deserves amplification the fact that Sinclair made its ABC affiliates cancel Nightline when that show named the U.S. service people killed in the Iraq War. So we aren't talking about stations having roundtables in which conservatives have a voice. We're hearing about, as you intimate, about folks who are watching the local news that they've watched for years. And then what's that? Suddenly you're watching something called the Terrorism Alert Desk, you know, and it's talking about how France might ban Muslim women's bathing suits.
Right, exactly. This is what they've sort of specialized in, is this kind of fear-mongering coverage. Here come the graphics announcing Terrorism Alert Desk, but then strangely, the stories are just about Muslims, as if those were the same thing. This is a station that's been caught doctoring audio to make it sound like anti-police brutality protesters were chanting kill a cop when they were chanting, you know, put killer cops in jail. There's so many of these instances that have happened on Sinclair stations that they aren't anomalies. They are only offering one hard right slant in their commentary, which they mix in, of course, with your normal traffic and weather and car crashes and local government stories. But anytime it comes to covering national politics, national news, they are putting a very hard slant on that. It might be your local anchor sometimes reading the lead into a script, but very often you're getting centrally produced political programming pushing an agenda. And moreover, I think to Jack Schaefer's points, what I always recommend when you look at what these companies are doing is you look at what they actually tell their investors. And what Sinclair is saying is not, hey, look, we're going out there to offer an alternative viewpoint. What they're saying is we're going to try to take over as much local news as we can. And they're aggressively pursuing an agenda not only to reach more than 70% of the country they'll get if this deal goes through, but then to begin start swapping and trading stations at the local level so that they can operate 2, 3, 4 stations in a given market, benefit from all that shared back end and domination of advertising to actually push the same content out on multiple stations. This has long been their model. They've set up a bunch of shell companies to carry this out, but now under the Trump administration, they've sort of come out of hiding and pretending, and they're just going for it.
Well, let me ask you about that relationship to Trump, but I first wanted to say, yeah, the CEO of Sinclair, I understand, has been quoted saying, right now there are 3 to 5 local players, and to us that doesn't make sense. I mean, it seems an assault on localism per se before you even get to the ideological piece.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's their business agenda. And I think that is also what blows up all these arguments. But, oh, we have so many choices for media today. And that might be true in some senses around entertainment, but it's absolutely not true when it comes to local news. Still by far the number one source of news and information for people at the local level. And you've got one newsroom broadcasting on multiple stations. There's no one out there competing for stories. There's no diversity of viewpoints being put forward. That's incredibly damaging at that local level where it's needed the most.
Well, now, Sinclair is not just ideologically sharing a worldview with Donald Trump. The relationship goes rather deeper than that, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. You know, this is a company that is essentially producing Trump TV, at least in terms of the national programming and the must-runs. There are, of course, good journalists at all these local stations just trying to do their jobs and report what's happening in the local community, but it is interspersed with essentially Republican Party talking points. And, you know, after the election, Jared Kushner somewhat infamously acknowledged that he had a deal, as he called it, with Sinclair to offer sort of uncut access to the Sinclair airwaves for Trump. Sinclair will tell you, oh, we offered the same deal to Hillary Clinton, but strangely, only Donald Trump took them up on it. And they've gone out of their way to hire former Trump campaign folks like Boris Epstein, who is now their top political commentator, who essentially operates as an extension of the White House. So we have a situation where you've got a network absolutely going to bat for the Republican Party, taking it upon itself, using all the same talking points and language that Trump does on fake news to essentially offer an alternative narrative about what's actually happening in Washington, attacking other journalistic outlets for aggressively covering the president, saying the Russia stuff is no big deal, and on and on and on, trumpeting Trump. Then turning around and saying, okay, we're here for our policy favors. We have a long wish list of limits on media ownership and other regulations that we'd like to get rid of, and the Trump administration actually making that a priority, either by loosening the rules or, in one case, actually reinstating a regulation the Obama administration got rid of in order to allow Sinclair to pretend its national reach, at least when they're at the FCC, to pretend that their national reach isn't as big as it actually is.
Now, I understand that even those who might be assumed to share their worldview are against this merger, other companies, and that's for different reasons. But still, you have other sort of what we might call right-wing outlets who themselves oppose the merger.
That's right. A number of groups filed formal challenges to the merger, including my group, Free Press, but also Newsmax, some local newspaper publishers, Dish Television. But it's been interesting to see the critique coming from the right, which I think rightfully recognizes this is just too much media power in one company's hands. And they know that if Sinclair is allowed to have this dominance over local television, then they're going to use all of that money, all of that income to move into other markets. They have an online news service called Circa. Once they start making all this money from these big markets, from what's called retransmission consent negotiations, which allows cable companies to carry local broadcast stations, from all the political ads, they're going to pour that in to undercutting their competitors on the right, even where there's ideological alignment. And I think, you know, what you're seeing here, and you're seeing this on the right and the left right now, is just growing concern about too much media power, growing appreciation of just how seriously we need to get about antitrust and other limits on one company getting so big that others can no longer afford to compete. And that's one of the things that's at risk if a deal like this is allowed to go through, especially because what will happen is it will inspire other companies to do their own deals to try to catch up. So you're going to see the Nexstars and the Foxes of the world suddenly saying, oh, well, Sinclair's got 200 stations. Maybe we need 200 stations as well. And suddenly you have even fewer choices at the local level, and those few remaining independent stations are finding it really hard to compete against the scale that these behemoths can offer to advertisers and others.
Well, let me just ask you, if power buys voice, and this does look a lot like favor trading, you know, where does dissent get air, and how do we fight this, and can we continue to fight it even if the merger goes through?
Well, I think we're going to have to continue to fight it. The first step is to try to push back at the Federal Communications Commission, and public comment is still open, and people can go to freepress.net. I urge them to file comments letting the commission know about their concerns. But ultimately, this is a matter that Congress and others are going to have to look at. That's going to be one of the key ways to push back here as we look at what is it going to take. It doesn't feel like these conversations are possible in the era of Donald Trump, but they're the ones we need to start having now is, what is it going to take to break up some of these media behemoths? This is absolutely going in the wrong direction, and I think you see a lot of signs. All this concern on the right, you can look at what's happening in Democratic circles where suddenly antitrust is at the center of the platforms that they're putting out there. We need to start moving in that direction to stop just rubber stamping these deals and start demanding that we need more local choices, more local accountability, more support for public and independent alternatives, because if we just allow these guys to merge and merge and merge, we'll be stuck with the same cookie-cutter content wherever we go, and it's going to be very, very conservative, if not reactionary, if somebody doesn't step in.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron from the group Free Press. As he notes, you can find their work, including learning how to talk to the FCC on this merger, at freepress.net. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This- This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Could you leave civilization and survive? Really? Are we permanently plugged in? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to A Mixed Bag of Greens this week. You'll hear Sri Lankan-American author Ashoka Bandaraji's Solution for Collapse and a classic conversation from the Four Seasons Garden to your dinner table with one of America's best-known organic growers, Barbara Damrosch. But first, this from the Mother Earth News Fair.
No one is meant.
Hi, Terry Jax, and you're listening to Radio Eco Shock.
Too many people everywhere. I wish I was down there.
This is Radio Eco Shock. I'm Alex Smith. Maybe something has triggered you that you would just like to run away from it all. It could happen in a commuter traffic jam. It could happen when your computer breaks down. Anything's possible. Have you ever felt like you'd like to leave it all? Would you like to walk away from civilization? Well, maybe you can. We're about to talk to somebody who has done it. Miles Olson is an author, he's a teacher, and he calls himself a professional dropout. He spent the last 10 years living in the woods of Vancouver Island in Canada on the West Coast. Miles Olson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
So, who were you before you left? Let's try and get a little bit of picture of Miles Olson.
Sure, good question. I was a teenager in high school before I left. I dropped out of high school when I was 17, and I guess I had been pretty disengaged from my studies for a couple of years, and I'd started cutting class to read books about edible plants and about ethnobotany and ethnology, and I'm not sure what exactly triggered. I think every teenage kid has dissatisfaction with the world they're in, typically. Teen angst, they call it. However it gets channeled is very unique in each individual. For me, for some reason, connecting to the land was where I went. I didn't start partying, doing drugs or anything. The land is where I went for my kind of fix on something that was more exciting than the drudgery of modern life. So, I read Thoreau and I spent probably a year fantasizing about doing what he did, building a little cabin and living in the woods and living simply and getting back to nature. And when I was 17, that's exactly what I did. I found out about a little abandoned cabin on an island called Morell Island, north of Vancouver Island, so very, very remote. Probably most of your listeners will have never heard of it. And there was, maybe a few people living on this island scattered about, and there's no hydro, no connection to the grid in any way. And I spent a summer living up there when I was 17. So that was my big jump out of the modern world, my big exodus into nature. That's where I had my first kind of revelations of who I was and what life is and what everything means, kind of alone in the wilderness. So I'm kind of answering your question in a pretty roundabout way, but who I was when I walked away from civilization was just a teenage kid who had lived in an artificial, human-constructed reality for his whole life. And when I walked out into the wild, away from the human-constructed world, it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. I completely regretted it. The minute I was dropped off on that island, I completely regretted ever going there. And there's probably a part of me that still regrets it, honestly.
Well, why do you say that? What brought about the regret?
When I was a teenager, the person who I was before I took that plunge, I had a lot of ideals and fantasies about what living close to the land would be. You know, I think I thought I was just going out to live the good life, and I was going to be like some clumsy bear in a Disney cartoon eating berries by the stream or something. And, you know, kind of an absurd idea of life in nature. And as soon as I was dropped off on this island, I hired a water taxi to ferry me there an hour from the nearest town, and I got dropped off, and the minute that the roar of that engine faded away into the ocean and I couldn't see the boat anymore, I instantaneously realized what I had done. I had this sinking feeling in my gut, and I was, oh no, I'm alone. This is real. There's no escape. There's no escape from me. All that's here is me and this silent, foreboding world. And I didn't know anything about that. I hadn't experienced silence before. There was always a background noise of traffic or people or music or something. And being dropped alone as a 17-year-old kid, fresh out of that ridiculous teenage world into wild nature, was just a complete juxtaposition of realities. And the reason I regretted it is that there was a part of me that knew that it was going to die as soon as I got there. As soon as I was stuck there for several months. And I guess I didn't know anything about this as a teenager, but apparently every indigenous culture, most cultures throughout all human history, have had this institution in them called the initiation or the rite of passage, where members of the culture would go away from the village, away from mass consciousness, basically, and experience real reality away from the village, you know, in wild nature, which is a pure form of reality, not based on any human construct, not based on any human idea. It's just, it has roots far deeper than any of that. It transcends time. And that's the situation that I accidentally put myself into. And I never, ever would have wanted to do that as a 17-year-old kid.
So what happened then? I mean, you came back, you made some plans, you...
So the first month of that first experiment going out into the wilderness alone was complete hell. I was living in complete hell. There was things that I had to do. I brought only so much food, so I had to learn how to catch fish. I brought a fishing rod. I had to pick berries. I had to pick greens. I had to plant a little garden. I brought seeds. I had to haul water every morning. I had to gather firewood. There was these non-negotiable terms of existence that I just actually had to do. I had to have water. I had to have food. I had to start a fire to cook the food. So I had to do all these things. But the whole time I was just, there was a chatter in my mind the whole time that was just growing and growing and growing. And there was no other human around to spew that out and to reassure me of who I was and what reality was. And yeah, there was just this incessant dialogue in my head of, why don't you just get a job and a girlfriend and be a normal person? Why don't, you know, you're just putrefying out alone in the woods. This is pathetic. You're pathetic. This is basically all of my ugliness, all of my ego, all of my shadow, every little wound, every little crack floated up to the surface for me to taste and linger in my mouth. And that's part of that process of initiation. That's exactly what the kind of ancient institution of initiation is going away from the human reality and then going through a process of purging so that you can come back to the world knowing a deeper truth than you could know from the human world. And after a month of living in complete misery, all of a sudden, one morning, I remember sitting on the porch of the cabin eating breakfast, and I could hear the birds singing. And I realized, I'm hearing birds singing. I had never heard birds singing before. I really had never heard birds singing before. And that's because I had always had something else going on in my mind louder than that. And that might not sound that profound, and maybe it's not that profound, but gradually, that was kind of the beginning of a gradual process that by the end of being there for maybe 3 months, all of a sudden, I was really enjoying myself. Life was really beautiful. Everything was this beautiful, ecstatic experience. My mind had slowed down, and I was sleeping outside every night underneath the stars. And instead of feeling pathetic and lonely and thinking about all these things I didn't have, I was just present to the beauty of that. And I was picking berries and drying them in the sun on old screens I had found, and catching fish and eating them, and just really present to the beauty of life and the rhythms. And when I came back after that, I was out there for maybe 3.5 months. And when I came back to the city that I grew up in, I got dropped off on the east side of town. I remember walking through to my parents' house on the west side of town. And I had to walk through suburbs to get there. And just being in a suburban landscape after that itself was an incredible shock. And I wasn't politicized at that age. I didn't have any ideas about what suburbs were, if they're good or bad. I didn't care. They were just where people lived. And that's where I lived. And now, all of a sudden, it looked gross. Looked weird. There was something heinous about it. And the reason I say that if I knew what was going to happen, I probably wouldn't have gone, is because it just changed my perceptions. And they haven't changed back.
Well, I can see a couple of parallels. First of all, I went every summer to an island that I was fortunate enough. Our family owned an island in northern Ontario, and I spent every summer there. We had no power, no cars, no nothing. But I did have my family, and we had neighbors and so on. So it's not quite parallel. But that prepared me for when I went and dropped out and went back to the land in the late 1970s. 200 acres, no power again, lived for 10 years that way. But again, I was quite integrated with a society around me. So it is a different situation, certainly, than you experienced. And I know what you're talking about with the spirit quest, though, and that's important. And I did hear silence when I was out there, and that is something that very few people have heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing, you know. Yeah. And that, in my case, it was with 8 feet of snow and no way out of the cabin. It's really, really quiet.
Yeah.
No planes overhead. You can't hear the highway. You couldn't even see any other houses from where I lived. So, you know, I kind of understand what you're talking about. Well, then you've called yourself a professional dropout, though.
Someone else actually gave me that moniker.
Did they? So what's the next stage?
So that's when I'm still a teenager when I came back from that island. And basically for the following 10 years, I've been, I guess, trying to integrate that experience into my life. I guess I never would think of that as a vision quest or something, but maybe that's a fair label for it. Maybe out of it, I got some call, some awakening that I felt like, yeah, I've needed to try and contextualize in my life. So for the last 10 years, basically, I've been living in a series of squats on the edge of a small city and learning how to hunt and gather, garden, scavenge, scrounge for my livelihood, and living communally with other people in what I call a feral homestead that we built, which has been fantastic. It's basically, we've proved to ourselves just the amount of freedom that you can really have if you just create it for yourself, if you create your own reality. Sounds kind of new agey almost now when I think about it, but what we did was we imagined something and then we created it. And the world never told us that that was an opportunity. When I was a teenager, my career classes never told me that, you know what, you could live for a decade without paying rent and you could live really well. And your life would almost be like going to university, but you write the curriculum because you can put all of that time and energy that you would have put into work into studying whatever you want. That's been how I've tried to contextualize all of that, is living intimate, trying to learn how to live close to the land, as close as possible. And for the initial period, that was very rough because I grew up in the suburbs. I didn't even know how to split wood until I was 17. I didn't know how to start a fire until I had to. And so it was a slow, laborious, and ridiculous and funny journey. And one of the reasons I wrote the book that I wrote was to offer some of the jewels that I feel like me and the community that I've been living with found through that journey.
And what's the title of the book?
The book is called Unlearn, Rewild: Earth Skills, Ideas, and Inspiration for the Future Primitive. So Unlearn, Rewild, I guess, pretty much sums up my philosophy, which is that when I was talking about my journey as a 17-year-old into the woods, I was walking away from civilization, so I thought. I thought that I was walking away from all the problems of the world, and I would go into the woods to just be in that pure nature, and everything was going to be awesome. What I realized after getting there was that the problems of the world were in me. I was saturated with them. And when I walked into the woods, I brought them with me. Because it's like a contagious illness that we all carry. And so before we think about healing the planet or anything, there's a lot of stuff that we need to unlearn. It's a very intentionally titled book, Unlearn, Rewild. There are these two verbs that go together quite nicely. There's this basically spiritual or at the level of consciousness, there's this problem, this is the root of our disconnect from ourselves and from the natural world. And yeah, without tackling that and dismantling that, we can't rewild, we can't fully integrate with the living world.
And you mentioned the bears, and I think we have a lot in common with the bears, actually.
Yeah.
I got to know some bears when we were living on our property. So do you think that we have this primitive still within us, always available? Is that always available to human race, or have we actually lost the primitive?
What do you mean by that, the primitive? Do you mean some kind of instinctual intelligence that's latent in us, like every other living thing?
Yes, I would say that, and also the capability to live without civilization. Can we really do that now?
That's a good question.
And maybe we'll have to. That's another question.
Yeah. My life over the last 10 years has not been in an extremely remote setting. Like I said, I've been living on the edge of a city in a series of squats. So I live on the edge of wildness and civilization, and I kind of like that. I like being able to dance between both worlds. I like being able to feed off both worlds. I live a very unconventional life. I don't have a job. I don't have a car. I don't have electricity. I don't have running water.
Have you got a visa?
No.
Okay.
But I do have an email account, and I do have a bicycle and, you know, things that are not completely primitive. The question of can we walk away completely from civilization, that's not really my area of interest. To walk away physically from civilization and just try and subsist completely off the wild, while I think that's valuable for experimentation and for revelation and for experience and fun, the real problem of our oppressive culture is at a deeper level than superficial. There's trappers who live on trap lines and beat up their kids and beat up their wives and live a subsistence lifestyle on the land. But they've got that sickness that is this culture's sickness. And it transcends form and space and where you are and how you live. Now, connecting to the land is one of the best ways to get rid of that programming, that artificial voice and all that oppressive behavior. But in itself, it is just a superficial act that might not necessarily have healing as part of it.
I almost picture it like you can never really leave the stage. We're actors. You can think that you're leaving the stage. And I also picture you when you're packing up your supplies, you're going to head off, you're 17, or maybe you're 32, you're going to leave civilization. You do put in that backpack all these problems that we haven't examined about ourselves and the voices that you talk about that I'm familiar with that are latent in us that are just started when we were little kids growing up in this civilization. Mm-hmm. For my generation, an older generation, it was the fear of the atomic bomb. I mean, that was just drilled into us. And I used to imagine running away and surviving somehow when I was 6 and 8 years old. And I know I'm not alone. There's a lot of people. And today I think there's a fantasy that we'll solve the problems of civilization when civilization collapses.
Yeah.
And then everything will be good.
Yeah. I talk about that in my book. And as an idealistic young squatter living close to land and basically learning how to survive without civilization, because we learned, and all these skills are in my book. My book is kind of a philosophical exploration and a collection of skills that I feel like are the most interesting and unique that I learned over 10 years living as a squatter on the land. We learned how to hunt, how to preserve all of our own food without industrial technology, how to tan hides and make clothing out of them, how to start fires without, you know, by friction, how to make bows and arrows and, you know, a lot of Stone Age skills that are awesome, fantastic skills to learn for connecting to the land. And we had kind of an idea that civilization is going to collapse and we're going to walk through the ashes of it. But at some point, we came to this realization, or at least I came to the realization that, wait a minute, what's driving this culture? We tend to think of it as a mechanical problem, the problem of sustainability. We're thinking, oh, we're burning too much fossil fuels, we need to burn less fossil fuels, and that will solve the problem. Or, oh, we have too many plastic bags, we need to have less plastic bags, and we've solved that problem. But the first culture that we would call a civilization that sprang up 6,000 years ago in what's presently Iraq, they developed farming for the first time. They were hunter-gatherers that started cultivating wheat from the floodplains. They started cutting down the forests where they lived. There were massive forests of cedar and cypress, not unlike the forests in the Northwest here. They started cutting down those forests and planting grain where the forests had been. They learned that you could do that with these annual grains, and they kept on doing that, and they learned how to divert the river so that they could irrigate these crops because they weren't in a floodplain anymore. And after several centuries, they had turned these forests into deserts. And it's really interesting because they did that all with organic farming and stone and bone tools, which suggests to me that the problem, it's interesting to note that that level of technology is the same as the level of technology that was here on the Northwest coast. And yet the people here didn't destroy their land base. And that suggests to me that the problem isn't necessarily a tactical one. It's not necessarily a mechanical one. It has a deeper root, because the only difference between the people here and the people there was what was in their mind, basically the way that they saw the land and the way that they interacted with it. It was a different, they had a different program.
Certainly, the idea of domination was in there.
Yeah.
And as pretty well, as soon as agriculture sprang up, so did wars. Continual wars.
Well, as soon as you start treating the land in an oppressive way, you start treating life in an oppressive way.
And women.
Yeah, they're alive too. Women, men, children, all of a sudden, all of these oppressive things come into the picture when you start oppressing anything. It's just, there's no duality, really, when you look at cultures that way.
And then, now I'm going to ask the impossible. Did you come up with some answers to this problem?
Yeah, I'll finish the last question that you asked, and then I'll go to this one. And what I was going to say is relating that to collapse, because people have this idea that if civilization collapsed, well, that might be a solution to these problems, because it doesn't seem to be slowing down on its own. But if the root of our problem is the stories that we're carrying and the programming in our minds and in our hearts, then if this culture falls, that problem has not been touched. And you haven't dealt with the problem of 7 billion crazy humans, which I would suggest is rather significant.
It's one big asylum at times. Okay.
But to tie that into your other question, if you frame the problem as we have all this stuff that we need to unlearn, it makes it much more complex, kind of. We won't just have the revolution today and the new world tomorrow. That's not going to happen if we all need to basically become whole people. If we need to all heal and reintegrate with ourselves and with the land and start having healthy, non-oppressive relationships. That's a very subtle, nuanced thing. And yet, I think it's actually far more realistic of an approach. And it's well known that insanity is contagious, I would say. That's a very unscientific statement. But everyone knows that abusive behavior begets abusive behavior. Someone who has been sexually abused in their childhood is very likely in adulthood to go on and repeat that behavior if they don't somehow heal from that. And that's just kind of how abuse is contagious, right? Our whole culture is built on that contagion. And I have a theory that sanity might be contagious as well. That whatever the dark, destructive element that has got everyone under its spell spreads, perhaps that's how another lighter element works. That's the only solution I have.
Well, there could be a wave of sanity. I could picture it. Other than that, we're left to alien intervention or magic mushrooms, you know. I mean, it's a tough problem. Well, we're starting to run out of time here. Miles Olson, it's been a fascinating talk. I'm going to ask you to tell us the title of your book again, because I'm going to have to read it, I think.
My book is Unlearn, Rewild, Earth Skills, Ideas, and Inspiration for the Future Primitive. And it's highly philosophical and highly practical. If you want to, if you just want to connect to the land in a deeper way, if you want to think about your relationships with humans and with the earth in a deeper way, then I highly recommend it.
Okay, and we can find out more at milesolson.net. And I'm not ready to walk away from civilization, but I sure am ready for it to change in a big way. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station.
stay tuned for our talk with Barbara Damrosch at the Mother Earth News Fair. But first, you know, our environment, species, climate, and economy are flirting with collapse. It's global, and it needs global eyes. Last week, we played a reading by Ashoka Bandaraji. Now it's time to speak with her. Is it possible we could be organic, solar-powered humans and still destroy the ecology of the world? Is there an inner destructive force we need to examine and change in order to evolve or perhaps even to survive? I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Ashoka Bandaraji is the author of the new book, Sustainability and Well-Being, The Middle Path to Environment, Society, and the Economy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Ashoka Bandaraji is a Yale PhD. She's the author of numerous publications in the field of global political economy, environment, population, and women's studies. She's a college professor and has taught at Brandeis, Mount Holyoke, Georgetown, American, and other universities. Our guest takes us from the early stages of collapse into a different path, the middle path. Ashoka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, I said the early stages of collapse because for most of us, maybe except for the billion peoples living in extreme poverty, real collapse has not yet come. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree because, you know, we are still believing that the status quo can continue and that we can succeed within the established institutions and the worldview.
And what systems do you think, though, are approaching collapse?
Well, certainly the environment, you know, there's all this data on climate change and global warming and its impact on communities across the world and the increasing numbers of environmental refugees, people who have been displaced due to disasters associated with climate change. There's also biodiversity loss that is rampant, and then chemical pollution. And I think that in the industrialized North, people are not so aware of the acuteness of these crises in many other parts of the world. For example, the use of chemical pesticides in agriculture and how that's leading to chronic kidney disease and other health problems in agricultural communities, for example.
Well, I would add to your list also the economy because the banking crisis and the way the high unemployment, there's a lot of problems there too. Well, now we have a system of giant banks and corporations and military organizations that seem to be taking us outside the planet's ability to support us, and yet these same institutions insist they are the only way. How would you describe this mode of thinking?
I think that the dominant worldview is that we can create a reality that is a market-based and technology-based reality, which sees humanity and the natural environment as resources to be used and almost as dispensable entities, when in fact we need to see things from an ecological perspective where we as human beings and certainly the economic system, which is a subsystem of a society, are embedded within this larger reality of the ecosystem and the environment. And we need to take an ecological perspective rather than this sort of mechanistic and market-based perspective, which is dominating and increasingly becoming the dominant approach to life. So much so that, you know, we are talking about bioengineering, biotechnology, creating new species, transhuman species, that is merging humans with machines and life as created in laboratories, you know, not just plants and animals, but increasingly human life itself. And that, of course, is the extreme, but that is the direction in which we are moving. Which is not to say that technology and the market don't have their place. And in fact, there are certain groups of people, particularly those who underconsume, who are in poverty-stricken situations, who need to consume more. And I think we need to have a middle path where there is more balance between the underconsumption of certain groups and the hyper-consumerism of certain other groups, and also in terms of technology, having a more balanced approach to technology, renewable sources of energy and alternatives to chemical pesticides, so on and so forth.
Yes, a less harmful technology, but still we can be smart about it. Now, in the legend of your namesake, the Emperor Ashoka, the supreme ruler, came to a recognition point and began social change to benefit all. Now, I personally doubt the most powerful groups in our time show any signs of making that transition. And if they don't, where does our hope come from?
I think it comes from professionals and middle-class people and educating people and consciousness, because the systems that we have in place are the products of human consciousness and thinking. And I think that people need to realize, and I think more and more individuals are realizing, that it is a very destructive path that we are on, a suicidal path, and rather than identifying with it in a very individualistic, competitive way that somehow we can survive in it, even if the environment is collapsing all around us and human societies are collapsing, rather to sort of really exercise our own power and try to take more leadership and provide direction. And I think in doing that, we also have to think about intergenerational justice. We have to think about the generations down the road. And that's where sort of a Native American thinking, for example, seventh generation sustainability, making decisions, taking into account the well-being of seven generations to come. And I think in this transformation of consciousness and social change, the so-called middle groups, professionals, intellectuals, have a very important role to play, because those who are at the very bottom are just trying to survive from day to day. They have hardly anything to eat, no shelter, no health care, so on and so forth. But those groups in the middle, rather than trying to identify with the 1%, so to speak, I think need to exercise their freedom of expression and really take a broad look at, you know, where we are headed, which means we have to really emphasize interdependence, because I think that is the one thing that I emphasize mostly in the book, that the problem is not even globalization or capitalism or communism as much as dualism. That is, we think in terms of self versus other rather than thinking in terms of interdependence, our connection with each other and the connectedness to nature, that we are, in fact, part of nature rather than separate from it.
Well, Ashoka Bandaraji, you draw from the tradition of Buddhism. Is it possible to reduce our mental suffering and still be activists working for change?
Absolutely, because being on a spiritual path, if you want to put it that way, is not sitting on a cushion meditating. While, you know, that is increasingly important, that kind of sort of inner reflection and inner development is essential. But also, how do we practice that on an ongoing basis in terms of our relationships to each other and how we live in the world? So Buddhism has, and I think many other spiritual traditions, have never been just about ritual or sort of individual self-advancement. I think it is about the community and our relationships to each other. So in that sense, the psychosocial transformation that I talk about in the book needs to be emphasized.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is author, scholar, and journalist Ashoka Bandaraji. Ashoka, in your book, Sustainability and Well-Being, you suggest our social movements are not enough and not working in the right directions. What is the problem?
Well, I have looked at environmental movements and social justice movements, and there is a historical tradition of these movements not always working together. And I, for example, give the case of ecofascism, where certain green movements, while they have upheld environmental sustainability, have actually worked against social justice and have stood not only for discrimination, but even genocide of certain groups. Just take the example of Nazi ecofascism. So I think it's important to bring these movements together, and certainly there are many movements trying to do so. But I think it is an environmental justice movement, particularly given the fact that it is people of color, people in the South, and poor communities who bear the brunt of environmental destruction more than privileged groups, although when it comes to environmental collapse, you know, it affects us all.
Well, before we return to the nagging problem of our destructive inner dialogue, I'm wondering if we can ground this a little bit in your own country of Sri Lanka. I know you are very familiar with the West, having taught in several American universities, but we know little to nothing about Sri Lanka other than it's near India, it was called Ceylon, and suffered both a tsunami and a civil war. Why not tell us how Western chemical companies affect the lives of the poorest people of Sri Lanka?
Yes, I'm glad you're raising that question because, you know, the tsunami and the civil war have received global attention. But things like chronic kidney disease that is rampant, widespread among agricultural communities, particularly in the north central province and in Sri Lanka, is really little known outside of the country. And very large percentages of the agricultural population, farmers, have been affected by kidney disease, and even the WHO, the World Health Organization, has attributed the chronic kidney disease to widespread use of chemical pesticides, you know, agrochemicals. And studying this issue, I found that this is not a problem peculiar to Sri Lanka, that in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua, and also the agricultural areas of India, that there is also similar cases of kidney disease that are suspected to be linked to widespread use of pesticides. And oftentimes these pesticides are things that have been banned in the industrialized north, and it is the poor, again, you know, who are mostly victimized by such diseases. But on the other hand, you know, the food and the products that create, you know, get circulated across the world, and certainly through the global economic trade and the ecosystem, it also comes back to the north. So again, you know, there is that interconnectedness of these environmental and public health issues.
And you've brought us back to the big picture. Now, various Western authors say our habit of domination began with agriculture and civilizations of the ancient Middle East. Those cultures damaged their environment, while native Indian cultures in the Americas apparently did not. Where in that picture does the ancient Asian culture fit into this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of generalize, you know, across Asia. For example, in Sri Lanka, there was a hydraulic civilization prior to European colonialism. People who have studied this, including some of my colleagues, have pointed out that the irrigational systems that were used at that time were actually more sustainable than the kinds of new irrigational infrastructure that have been introduced through World Bank and other Western-funded organizations that have involved, you know, massive dam building and massive infrastructure, displacement of population, so on and so forth. So even there, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from pre-modern traditions of agriculture and cultivation. And also those systems were not the monocultural crop production like that was introduced by the British with, say, tea plantation. You know, they were more diversified agricultural production, which included, you know, rotating the soil, rotating the different areas that were cultivated with different plants over time, and certainly the use of more natural pesticides.
Well, I'm worried about Sri Lanka because, as we learn from the tsunami, so many people lived right along the coast and depend upon it for their survival. And yet, with rising seas, we're going to see more violent storms and higher waters washing over. I know Sri Lanka is also a very mountainous country. There are places to go, but it's hard to see how your country will adapt to climate change.
Yeah, I'm glad you're raising that issue because, just south to Sri Lanka are the Maldives, which are, you know, hundreds of atolls, and they are predicted to go under. And in fact, the Maldivian government has been talking about relocating their entire population elsewhere. And Sri Lanka, too, is an island, and many of the coastal areas have been repopulated again, I mean, the coastal belt. And also the kind of tourism, and although sometimes it's referred to as ecotourism, is also putting a toll on the coastal belt. And I don't think there is, you know, enough attention being given to these looming problems, you know, despite the devastation that was caused by the tsunami a few years ago. And also there is, you know, massive deforestation, and in the name of development, like in many other parts of the world, for example, the elephant population is being wiped out because their homes, the forest is being destroyed.
That makes me very sad to hear that. Now, I would like to get a more concrete grasp on this idea of the middle path for our listeners. We're busy. We want specifics. What can we do with this idea of the middle path?
Yeah, the middle path, I think that when we talk about sustainability and simple living and cutting down on consumption, particularly in the West in terms of meat consumption, people get very scared and they feel threatened. And I think it is important to point out that it is not about going back to our foraging history, where we spent 99% of our lives as human beings, and there was a kind of stasis. There was no material technological development at that time. And I don't think that sustainability calls for that. But on the other hand, sustainability also is not compatible with unbridled growth. I think there's got to be regulation. There's got to be limitations on the kind of technology that we use, limitations on use of fossil fuel, and, you know, limits on consumption. And to get to that point of a middle path, a balance, I think it's about living in balance with nature and not disturbing the natural equilibrium of nature, which is not to say that nature doesn't change, but we are changing nature in such a rapid pace that it is collapsing around us. So I think it is not to say that we should have no growth, like some conservationists and radical environmentalists would say. So I think that is where the middle path comes in. It is not a complete no to growth, but it is a more balanced growth, rational use of resources, and solar technology, wind technology, as opposed to, say, the Keystone Pipeline, for example. So I think that is where it comes in, that it's an alternative to unbridled growth and no growth, but it has to be a much more conscious process, which involves a kind of an inner transformation where we have to ask, what are our needs? And putting more energy in terms of our social development and our inner development, not just the technological and material development.
Well, you've given us a lot of powerful ideas, I think. My guest has been Ashoka Bandaraji, appearing in the Huffington Post and author of at least 5 books. Her latest is Sustainability and Well-Being. If you want to travel outside ideas that are not working, give her book a try. Find her at bandaraji.com, spelled B-A-N-D-A-R-A-G-E. Thank you so much, Ashoka, for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, and keep up the good work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. Now, the New York Times called her the Queen of Organic Growers. She has a weekly column in the Washington Post and numerous television appearances with husband Elliot Coleman. They run Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. Barbara Damrosch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I interviewed Elliot a couple of years ago, I think it was, and 2 things really stuck in my mind about greenhouse gardening, and one was keep it in the ground, not up on these raised planting tables.
We grow in the soil.
Right.
No need to have these benches.
And it works out for a lot of reasons. We could talk about that at length, I'm sure. And the thing that I think is particularly intriguing to me now, talking with you today, is the idea of, all right, you've grown these particular greens that will grow in the climate that we've got. How are you going to really eat them? How are you going to prepare them? How are you going to get them into the kitchen? And that's the topic of your new book, I believe.
Yes, yes. Half of the book is growing and half of it is cooking.
Okay, so what's the title of the book?
The Four Season Farm Gardener's Cookbook. We were sort of emphasizing the cookbook part because it's the first time we've ever done a cookbook. And so people have been asking us for years, when are you going to do a cookbook? Especially me, because I always, when I lecture, I always show pictures of things I've cooked. And so we finally did it.
What do you think are some of the vegetables that we can grow ourselves that present a challenge to make them interesting and table ready?
I think almost anything that you have an awful lot of is a challenge because you're eating it every day. Like, for instance, we're in asparagus season right now back home. And the first time you pick it, it's just like, oh, I haven't tasted asparagus since last year. And it's so wonderful. And then but you're going to go and pick it for 6 weeks and make the most of that wonderful season. So the more you can do to think of different ways of cooking it, the better. And I think that's true of everything. So like, I will steam it with butter very simply, and I'd be happy to eat it that way every day. But then after a while, I'm making omelets with it or a quiche with it or, you know, maybe creamed on toast or something like that. And a lot of the recipes I have are ones like the ones I just mentioned that I could use with something else that's in season. So maybe 3 months from now, I'd be putting leeks in all those recipes.
You know, I think you can almost overdo it when things do come in. I just went on a rhubarb binge, and then I realized I had a little bit too much rhubarb. It's a very strong vegetable.
It certainly is. In fact, it's not my favorite thing. And we have grown it. I have definitely grown it. I have cooked with it. And there are ways of making it delicious, but it's not for everybody. I think it has to be sweetened a lot. It is very tart.
Definitely. So you're getting some sugar. What happens with your food diet in the kitchen when it's wintertime in Harborside, Maine?
Well, we have so many things that we grow fresh that we don't just rely on storage crops. I mean, we have all of those too. You know, we store potatoes and carrots and beets and turnips and winter squash. But at the same time that we have, for instance, storage carrots, we have fresh dug carrots that we can pull all winter long up until the point where they start to regrow. So about mid-February, they start to send up new foliage and taste less sweet. But spinach will grow all winter long. Baby leaf crops like arugula, mosh, the small lettuces. Anything is more winter hardy if you grow it at a baby leaf size. And the advantage to that as well is that you can keep picking it and it'll keep producing.
I spoke with a professor from Guelph University. They have an agricultural college
there.
Yes,
we've spoken there.
Yes. Well, he operated a greenhouse, and one of the things he told me was that for some of his crops, they weren't really growing very much, and in fact, he didn't water them at all. It was almost like a method of storing fresh food so that you could pick it right there and put it on the table fresh, as opposed to, okay, I'm going to get a big crop out of this.
That's so well said. In fact, one person once described our farm as a giant crisper drawer in the refrigerator. Because basically, the way you time these crops is that you plant them until they attain harvestable size at just about the point where it becomes very cold and their growth is going to slow down. So they will sit there from maybe, in our case, October into early February in suspended animation. They won't die, but they won't get any bigger either. So basically, we apportion out the bed. So we're allowed to pick, say, this many feet of spinach this week and then another 10 feet or whatever it is the following week. Because we're marketing these, of course, not just in our case, where it's not just for home consumption, although it is too.
Well, there are people starting up their home businesses on not very big pieces of land.
Isn't that wonderful? And these are the wonderful crops to do that with. It's a nice little niche crop that, you know, fresh food that most people don't think is available, or maybe is shipped from all the way across the world or something like that.
Yeah, I interviewed one fellow. He had a city lot. Now, this was in California, but he was selling to specialty restaurants and making a reasonable living from it.
Well, we can get $140,000 gross of vegetables off of an acre and a half. So that's at least $80,000 an acre. That's very high yields.
You have stunned me. I had no idea that was possible.
You can. And there's a lot of labor involved with it, but we're working on that. Elliot has a lot of tools in the pipeline that mechanize the small farm to just the degree that you don't have to hire as many people.
Well, talking about the labor idea, now, everybody wants to grow their own food, I think, or a lot of our listeners do for sure, but they also have busy lives, you know, they're raising kids, they're trying to make a living somehow as well. Is it possible to raise a portion of your own food, or is that something we have to leave for our future dreams?
Well, I think it depends on your time and your space. Those are the dual constraints. And this book, we were very, very conscious of trying to help people solve that problem. You know, first of all, we talk about what you can do if you only have a garden the size of your dining table, say. You know, there's quite a bit you can grow if you do cut and come again crops, succession crops, interplanting. It takes a certain amount of strategy. But then we also tell people how to have a big garden if they want to go and really do it. And there's a lot of tricks there, again, for saving space and saving time. So you never let any part of the garden go blank. It's like on radio. You don't want dead air. You don't want dead space in a garden. And we have lots of tricks for just doing everything more quickly. We have a rake with little markers that let you go zip down a bed and then zip the other way and make a planting grid for transplants that would take you so much longer if you were stretching out strings and measuring tapes. This is just almost instant. Same in the kitchen. I have all kinds of recipes that are much quicker than the traditional equivalent. So, for instance, I make a quiche. I don't make a pastry crust, and that's a nuisance. I mean, it's fun, but it takes time. You don't always have time to do that. So it's just I smear the pan with butter, and I shake buckwheat groats, and that lines it. And then you just put your filling in, and the moisture in the filling cooks the wonderful sort of nutty crust. And so it's just so easy and so fast.
I want to try that.
Well, there you go. There you go. I have a cake where instead of having to make a frosting, you just use flavored whipped cream and whatever fruit's in season and flavor the cream according to what the fruit is. And you know, create your own moment for that recipe based on what you have, even if it's just some marmalade you've put up or something like that.
Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Barbara Damrosch. And I want to make a shout out to any young mothers out there and young fathers. For heaven's sakes, teach your boys how to cook. We've got a whole generation being raised up on... They're ending up on fast food, and it's bad for everybody's health. What's your feeling about this? How are we going to get men cooking?
Well, that's a good question. And it's funny because my son grew up loving to cook. I mean, he was a macho kid. He was good at a lot of sports. He was a big guy, you know, all of that. So he wasn't threatened by the fact that he was interested in cooking. And so he signed up for his high school home ec class. He enjoyed it a lot. And I mean, he taught them how to make hollandaise sauce in a blender. You know, it was wonderful. And he still cooks, like cooks up a storm. My husband, Elliot, is not the cook of the family, but there's certain things that he's really good at doing. He's good at making stir fries and scrambled eggs, and he makes wonderful little pizzas out of tortillas or chapatis. I don't know how you do it. You just hopefully get them hooked, maybe through the taste. I don't know.
I think it's partly a generational thing, too, though. I think if we can get the kids cooking when they're young, they're going to do a lot better.
Sure. Take the time. Instead of saying, get out of the kitchen, I'm busy, you know, just show them a few things.
Yeah, get them up on the counter measuring out the flour, whatever you got to do.
Right, right.
Yeah. So what are you going to tell people at the Mother Earth News Fair when you do your presentation?
Well, I'm just going to show them a few time-saving tricks, but I'm also going to just show... What a pleasure it is to eat with the seasons. You know, as Americans, we think we're entitled to walk into a supermarket and have anything we want on any day of the year. Bring in a recipe, you can find every single ingredient right there. Whereas we want the garden to inspire the recipe, because the real luxury for us, the real entitlement, is to get that vegetable or fruit, whatever it is, at the moment where it's perfect. So instead of, you know, being satisfied with melons that were ripened a long time ago in artificial conditions, like the melons I had this morning in a hotel, you know, breakfast. It was pretty awful. I'm waiting for the real melons that we get ourselves at the end of the season in Maine. And it's just, it's an ecstatic experience to have that flavor that you've waited for.
Right. You know, tomatoes are such a disappointment to me. Wherever you find them, they don't taste like tomatoes anymore. I've read that they've been bred for shipping.
Yeah, they've been bred for shipping. Yeah, forgotten to breed flavor into them. They're uniform. They're tough-skinned. They're not very interesting. Often produce is ripened by ethylene gas as opposed to natural ripening. I don't think that gives you particularly good flavor.
Yeah, or they ship it totally green, and eventually it ripens, but you might get it a month later.
Sun-ripened is the way to go.
It is, and there's nothing like a peach when that's in season.
That's right. We have a two-week peach season. We can only grow one variety in Maine. It's hardy, called Reliance. It's not a particularly great peach, but it's our peach. And we enjoy it when it happens.
I didn't know you could grow peaches in Maine. But things are also changing. The plant hardiness map has been changed because of climate change.
Right.
Things are warming up, and there's more stress for some people as far as drought goes for their plants. It's a challenging time to be a gardener.
Yes, it's unpredictable. The trouble with what we're experiencing with climate is that it's a lot of crazy extremes.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, we're having a very cold spring. We did last year, too.
Yeah, and then you got the tremendous floods with, was it Irene, Hurricane Irene? So much rain came.
Yeah, it's all or nothing.
They had 10 inches in San Antonio a few weeks ago. That's a lot of rain for San Antonio,
what do you
Texas.
Do with it all? My goodness.
It just floods everything out, including your garden. And I think people have to be a little more aware when they set up their gardens about how they're going to deal with either a lot of rainfall or none.
That's a good point.
You know, and your water management. It's really
mm-hmm.
important.
That may be collected into a pond or something.
Yeah, or the rain barrels.
Rain barrels are perfect. Go right off your roof. Yeah. Although in Colorado, you're not allowed to do that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, because it's part of the conservation that they want the earth to absorb the water.
Well, I heard a different story. I heard that in some states, at least, somebody's bought the water rights, say, to the river or whatever, and the rain is what's supposed to feed it.
That could be part of it, too.
To tell somebody you can't collect the rain that falls on your own property.
Isn't it?
Have you got a new book that you're working on or a new project in the works?
No, I'm taking a little rest. I'm going to be doing some writing and photography for Mother Earth News magazine. One reason I was delighted to come to their fair today. And I have a great respect for that magazine. They seem to go more into depth about everything and just take it a little further. I get a lot of information from it. So anyway, I'm going to be writing for them and just really working on the farm, giving it all I've got.
Right. And do you have a blog with Mother Earth News or your own blog? Or?
No, I'm going to be starting a series, but it won't start until next summer, about cooking and growing. Similar to the material in the book. But I'm writing an article right now that will come out, I think it's early fall, about the best varieties and types of plants to grow in cold weather.
Great. And how about giving us the website as we finish up?
It's fourseasonfarm.com. And that's fourseasonfarm.com. So no S at the end of season, no S at the end of farm.
Okay, I think we can remember that. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It's been a pleasure to have Barbara Damrosch on the show.
Thank you so much, Alex. A great pleasure of mine.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Find more links to all our guests in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to the Mother Earth News for arranging some great interviews at the recent fair in Puyallup, Washington. Special thanks to all the listeners who donated at our blog or website so I could afford to get my recording gear to the fair. Become part of the program yourself at www.ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening again this week.
And welcome to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And I notify you, by the way, next week we're going to be preempted as a special program. And so just let you know that. today we're going to talk about a number of things, but the we have Clancy Siegel, an interview we did with him, and we're going to replay some of that. That'll be coming up. And then we're going to talk to David Jacobs, a Toronto lawyer, about two matters. One, the new book by Professor Harry Glaspick, and it's called Class Privilege, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism. I know that David Jacobs admires this book very much. He's going to tell us about it. And folks should know, by the way, you can get that from Between the Lines Press. And we'll also be asking him about there's been a decision made in a British court that bears on the whole matter of what kind of government exists in Rwanda and what kind of justice has been dispensed in the whole matter of the war genocide, it's called, of 1994. Really important decision. And so David Jacobs is going to tell us about that. And, of course, we want to tell everybody, David Himbara has his new book, Kagame's Killing Fields, is now available Kindle. I urge you to go to David Himbara's Twitter. You can just write his name, and you will get all the latest news, but also ways to acquire the book. He has promised he'll be our guest, and we look forward to talking to him. There is a presidential election. Ha, 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 ha. If you're into that kind of humor, it is predicted that Paul Kagame will probably get 98% of the vote. We have talked on this program, David Himbara did, about the fact there's a wonderful woman, Diane Rwigara, who stood up to Kagame. She lives in Rwanda, and she put her name forward to run for president, and she, surprise, surprise, was disallowed. When the Reuters spoke to the elections officer, he had a peculiar, morbid comment. I mean, he said, "Well, we checked the names that she had submitted, you know, in order to have enough names to get on the ballot, and many of the people on that list were dead." And my question was, you mean they're going to be dead or they are dead? Because that place, you know, if you are prominent Rwandan, there's a good chance you're going to be dead. He might have been, you know, he might have got the tense wrong, is what he meant to say. But she was not allowed to run, not allowed. The occasion will be next Friday. I think the 4th of August. Now, Phil Conlon is here, and we think it's our job to pass on what we know about the vote in Venezuela yesterday. And Phil, what have you got there?
So I have an article from Venezuela Analysis. This is a website that reports news from Venezuela but does not rely on the New York Times and the Globe and Mail and these people who are just reporting what basically Wall Street wants you to hear. Venezuela Analysis, this article is written by – you want me to read the article now, Phil? Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. The author is Lucas Kerner. He's in Philadelphia. And the headline is Venezuela Sees Historic Turnout in National Constituent Assembly Elections. Venezuela's National Electoral Body announced Sunday evening that 8,089,320 people had participated in the day's National Constituent Assembly elections. Shortly before midnight, National Election Council President Lucena revealed that turnout in elections to choose delegates to the body tasked with rewriting the Constitution was 41.5%. The balance of the day is extremely positive because, as we always say, peace won out, and when peace wins, Venezuela wins, she declared on national television. Speaking from the Plaza Bolivar in Caracas shortly after the CNE announcement, President Maduro hailed the large vote total as indicative of the new body's legitimacy. The National Constituent Assembly is born with a great popular legitimacy, he affirmed. According to CNE records, the total number of votes for the ANC, which is the Constituent Assembly, surpassed the 7.5 million votes received by Maduro in his narrow 2013 election victory and comes in as a close second to the late President Hugo Chavez's 2012 re-election triumph with 8,191,000 votes. Sunday's turnout likewise exceeds the participation in the 1999 consultative referendum on whether to convene a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution, which stood at 37.65%. While the vast majority of the constituent assembly's 545 delegates were elected on Sunday, indigenous assemblies will convene this coming Tuesday in order to choose their 8 representatives. So that's the news from Venezuela. Very different in tone, obviously, from what you're getting on the mainstream press.
Yes, it's very important. And in my opinion, we do this. We will come back to this story, keep on this matter, because Chrystia Freeland has decided to jump in today in the Globe and Mail. She says that Maduro is inching closer to authoritarian rule. Freeland says, "Well, her friends in Kiev got in power by using guns, and there never was an election. They drove an elected president, drove him from office by violence." And Freeland said, "We're all Ukrainians," so she was in on it. But she gets that, of course, through her DNA and her love for her grandfather, who was a Nazi collaborator, and she didn't have any problem with his being a Nazi collaborator. And to this day, feels she doesn't even have to talk about the subject. And meanwhile, she and this government have sold weapons now being used. It's now certified. Those weapons that were sold to Saudi Arabia, I would tell her, in case she didn't know, it's an absolute monarchy. They kill people for writing poems. They kill people for sending Twitter remarks about the royal family that are not flattering. So they kill them, chop their heads off. They do it in public if Freeland wants to attend. She could probably put in – she gives them so much money, she could be able to attend the executions at the very least. So she doesn't have a damn problem with autocracy at all or authoritarian rule. She has no problem with it as long as it's her friends. And as I said, she comes from a long line of people who believe in it. So it's disgusting to read such things in the Globe and Mail. And I read the Toronto Star, by the way, which is very much against Maduro – and against the Venezuelan government, which is continuing the Bolivarian revolution, which is to serve the poor. And you want to see – there's some little evidence. They go after him. This is from Sunday's paper, but I like this sentence. It says, in the opposition strongholds of relatively wealthy eastern Caracas, skinny teenagers manned barricades and of tree branches and – other things. But I like the phrase relatively wealthy eastern Caracas. And then and the next paragraph begins, the rest of the capital was calm. So, okay, so I understand. The rich are unhappy and the poor were calm. But nonetheless, the U.S. and Canada and Peru and Argentina, which has had a kind of coup in Argentina, and there's been a kind of coup in Brazil where the right wing took over. And again, Canada couldn't be happier that that happened. Mr. Lula, who was one of the great popular leaders of this hemisphere, a man, a product of the trade union movement, who has really delivered for the oppressed poor of Brazil, he's now facing long, long prison sentence. Canada couldn't be happier. America couldn't be happier. So when they tell us, oh, we're worried about Venezuela, spare me your tears. That's all, as they say, alligator tears. One other matter, of course, we know, I'm sure our listeners already heard, the Mooch has been removed. 10 days, and Mooch the Pooch is no longer the communications director for President Trump. I'm really sorry about that because I wanted to start talking about where he's from. He's a Goldman Sachs man. And so, you know, I saw him as your basic used car dealer, you know, from years ago. But now it turns out he's a Goldman Sachs guy. And what I'm very impressed with, and he went to Harvard. I'm impressed with what sleazy, filthy morons they all are. It's have they no upbringing? Didn't nobody tell them don't talk like that? They try to top each other. I am disappointed in our rulers. I thought they had a certain amount of, you know, they knew how to put on airs, but they don't. They've all gone bonkers. Look up his cursing, by the way. It's really Class A Lower Bowery stuff, you know, and hard to find. I mean, I actually don't know people who say those things. I was in the Marine Corps. I never heard anybody say that stuff. It's amazing. So there is that. And as I said, we want to play part of – it's not going to be the entire Clancy Siegel interview from 2013, October the 15th. But I just want to say that we had hoped and had an understanding of, from Clancy. We were going to be talking to him about his latest book, published shortly before he died, which is called Black Sunset. I highly recommend that book, as well as his great novel, Going Away, and the film he wrote together with his wife, Janice Tidwell, who Janice Tidwell made an outstanding part in. The film was called Frida and won many prizes. Actually, most people know him for Frida and know Janice Tidwell. I spoke to Janice Tidwell. She will be speaking to us sometime in the near future. But we want to give you a taste of Clancy Siegel, what he was like. He was very high on Ernest Hemingway, particularly because of Hemingway's guts in supporting the Republican government of Spain and his friendship for Cuba. People forget these things about Ernest Hemingway. So we'll listen to some of Clancy Siegel.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brenda Shum of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who talks about the Trump Justice Department plan to investigate and sue U.S. universities for alleged discrimination against white applicants. A report on a Connecticut community that stood in solidarity with Guatemalan immigrant Nuri Chavarria, who was under a federal deportation order and was later granted a temporary stay. And Hillary Shelton, director of the NAACP Washington Bureau, who discusses the reasons behind his group's issuance of a Missouri travel advisory due to a rise in racial hate crimes and a new Jim Crow-era state law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time in 3 years, Greece sold bonds to European investors to demonstrate that the indebted nation is making a comeback. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras praised the 3 billion euro bond sale, boasting that the worst part of the economic crisis was clearly behind his nation. Despite recent success in the bond market, skepticism runs deep among the Greek people and European investors that the days of International Monetary Fund bailouts are over. Greece has accepted over 320 billion euros in bailout funds over the last 7 years, as the standard of living has fallen dramatically. Greece continues to carry a staggering level of debt, nearly twice as large as its economy, beating predictions of a fourth IMF European Union bailout after the current bailout expires next August. The anti-austerity Syriza party came to power 2 years ago to confront EU creditors. Yet, Prime Minister Tsipras quickly accepted an IMF bailout plan harsher than the one rejected by a majority of Greek voters in a national referendum. During the nation's debt crisis, the net worth of the average Greek family has fallen 40%, where more than 20% of the workforce remains unemployed. Pensioners have seen the value of their retirement benefits cut in half since 2009, and 15% of the Greek population now lives in extreme poverty. Chicago police officers elected a fiery new union president, Kevin Graham, in April, who pledged to take on the anti-police media. This provoked a drive to reform the police union contract, which had expired at the end of June. Community activists have identified 14 current contract provisions which shield police officers who are under criminal investigation. One such provision allows police officers to wait 24 hours to give a statement after shooting someone. Another prohibits anonymous complaints against officers. In mid-June, six activist groups, including Black Lives Matter, filed a federal lawsuit to require the city of Chicago to accept court oversight of police reforms. The suit calls on the city to negotiate a consent decree with community groups instead of Donald Trump's Justice Department led by Jeff Sessions. In the Chicago City Council, a dozen aldermen signed a resolution calling for Mayor Rahm Emanuel to support the 14 contract reforms identified by the Coalition for Police Contract Accountability. One of the most controversial provisions in the current police contract is the requirement for a sworn affidavit to investigate misconduct by police officers, revealing the name of the complainant to the accused officer. Over the last decade, the city of Chicago has spent $500 million defending police misconduct lawsuits. However, 40% of those cases were dropped due to the lack of a signed affidavit. Retired coal miner T.J. Fannin stacks up cases of bottled water in his house for cooking and drinking. For over a decade, the chemical pollutants in drinking water in eastern Kentucky have violated safety levels set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Despite years of complaints, local officials in Martin County, Kentucky, say the drinking water is safe. Officials say the focus on bad water quality are amplified by mandatory EPA notices and a crusading newspaper, the Mountain Citizen. According to the Christian Science Monitor, local water systems in Martin County have violated EPA safety levels for drinking water every year since 2005. The EPA notices posted for Martin County residents warn that high chemical levels in drinking water elevates the risk of cancer. Community activists complain local officials have not invested enough funds to repair the water infrastructure system. Instead, officials built a new courthouse. Martin County's water system, including its treatment plant, were built in the 1960s to serve a population of 600 people, but now the county provides water to over 3,500 customers. Inadequate sewage treatment, spills from local industry, coal mines, and gas drilling, as well as leaking pipes, have all contributed to mass contamination of surface waters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
News reports indicate that the Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources within the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division to launch investigations and possibly initiate lawsuits against universities over affirmative action admissions policies that they determine discriminate against white applicants. In a 4-3 ruling in a 2016 affirmative action university admissions case, the Supreme Court upheld a race-conscious program at the University of Texas at Austin. However, current lawsuits challenging similar university admissions policies favoring diversity on campus have targeted Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. The project to investigate alleged discrimination against white university applicants will be run by Trump political appointees at the Justice Department and not career civil servants who normally handle cases involving higher education institutions. This follows a pattern at the Trump Justice Department, where policy decisions on issues of voting rights, discrimination against the LGBTQ community, and police misconduct appear to be driven by a white nationalist ideology. Your reporter spoke with Brenda Shum, director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who explains why civil rights groups across the country challenge the veracity of reverse discrimination charges and plan to oppose Trump administration litigation attacking university policies promoting diversity.
This move by the Justice Department to assemble a team of attorneys who are being asked to investigate and challenge race-based admissions really signals another step forward in this administration's pretty aggressive campaign to roll back civil rights protections for some of our most historically disadvantaged students, and that includes transgender youth, women and girls, and students of color. And I think it's important for your listeners to view this move in context with other evidence that the Justice Department is departing from its core mission of protecting the civil rights of all citizens, including those related to voting, employment, policing, and immigration. And this newest assault on affirmative action in higher education ignores the law. It ignores a growing body of social science research on the educational benefits of integrated learning environments. And more importantly, it is out of step with our entrenched history of segregated education and the variety of ways in which it continues to impact the experience of students today.
Brenda, I would ask you to respond to the allegation that there are white applicants who are victims of reverse discrimination. How do you assess charges that white applicants for colleges and universities across the U.S. are meeting with some strong headwinds and can't get into college?
That's an important question, and before I address that, I want to be very clear that just last year, the Supreme Court validated the constitutionality of race-based admissions policies as long as they're applied in a holistic and narrowly tailored way. In Fisher v. Texas, our highest court reaffirmed that universities are entitled to use race as one of many factors in order to achieve the educational benefits of diversity, entirely consistent with the law and the Constitution. We understand that there are a number of those who believe that affirmative action should be equated with an unfair advantage, and that is simply untrue. If you take a look at the empirical data, it very clearly demonstrates that the admission policies which have been challenged, those at the University of Texas, those are those which are currently being challenged at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, race is just one of many factors that is considered by a university when trying to make a determination about how to diversify its student body. And racial diversity is just one aspect of what a university is considering. It is not the only factor that is determinative of what decisions are made with respect to offers of admission.
And as to the plans of the Justice Department, I would assume that there's no real ability to preempt what they may be planning in terms of lawsuits against universities. But groups like yours, I imagine, can intervene and support the institutions that may be on the attack list of the DOJ. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think that this is a really good opportunity for me to just mention for your viewers, for your listeners' benefit, that this strategy that's being adopted by the Department of Justice really marks a departure from their tactics in previous administrations, and not just the Obama administration. The Department of Justice has never initiated litigation related to race-based admissions. Those are normally brought by private parties, and at most, the Department of Justice may decide to file a statement of interest or may decide to file a motion to intervene. Moving forward, the Lawyers Committee is in the process of developing a strategy to issue a variety of public information records requests, some FOIA requests, where we are going to be seeking information to try to insert some level of transparency into the department's agenda. And we look forward to being able to share that information with the public once it becomes available.
That was Brenda Shum, Director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Find links to news and analysis about higher education diversity policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Norwalk, Connecticut resident Nuri Chavarria fled violence in Guatemala 24 years ago and has been living and working in Connecticut ever since. She has four children, including one with cerebral palsy. After being arrested on a minor traffic violation, she checked in with immigration officials every year and was allowed to remain in the country. But under the Trump administration, even immigrants with no criminal record and strong ties to the U.S. have been targeted for deportation. Chavarria was ordered to fly back to Guatemala on July 20th, but instead took refuge in La Iglesia de Dios Pentecostal Church in the Fairhaven section of New Haven. However, less than a week after Chavarria took sanctuary, a federal immigration court in Hartford granted her a stay of deportation, allowing her lawyers to present new information in her fight to stay in the U.S. permanently. Upon hearing the news, she immediately returned to her home in Norwalk to be with her children and get back to work. Before Chavarria was granted a temporary reprieve from deportation, about 200 supporters attended a rally on her behalf on July 23rd at the church where she had taken sanctuary. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and recorded those that spoke up for Chavarria. One of the speakers at the rally was the Reverend Paul Fleck of Hamden Plains United Methodist Church.
You are to treat the foreigner as the citizen among you and not oppress her, for you were once foreigners in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I'm here to tell you today that Nuri and her family are wheat, not weeds. Wheat, not weeds.
And I should also mention that this individual right here posted a list on our on an Amazon wish list of needs that Nuri and her family had, and that in less than 12 hours, everybody had exhausted every item on that list.
Another of the speakers was Alec Bott, a leader of the Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance.
We've had the opportunity to witness the strength and resilience of a woman and a mother who made the fearless decision to remain home out of love for her family and out of defiance of a racist and unhinged immigration enforcement regime. We really appreciate that by coming together, we collectively have been able to reciprocate and manifest the spirit and sense of unity that Nuri has shown us. And I just want to appeal to y'all that this case, that this incident is not just one single incident of injustice. This is the symptom of a sick and unjust system. So being that clearly we all understand this, I want to make an appeal to y'all tonight. Let's use this opportunity to establish a precedent right here, right now. Because the nature and levels of the threats against our communities are such that we haven't witnessed before in our lifetime. But if Nuri and her story and just by us by being here tonight have demonstrated anything, it's that we are strong. And then as we continue to build and as time continues to move, we will only get stronger. So let's not let tonight be the end of it. Let this be the beginning of something new. Let's make this the beginning of the transformation of our community. Let's make the beginning of the transformation of our society into a place that we want to make, into a place where we can all live peaceably, into a place where no matter who's facing something, if they have a criminal record or not, let's all come together. So as I step off this mic, I'm not going to say goodbye because these things are going to keep happening, but we're going to keep being here. So I'm going to see y'all. Thank you. Gracias.
Many people don't know this, but Amazing Grace is actually a song that was written by a slave trader, someone who used his power to subjugate people and bring them against their will to the United States to be slaves. And this man who wrote this song had an experience of transformation where his heart, which was bent towards oppression, changed. And every time I hear it and every time I sing it, I'm reminded of how important it is to believe that even people whose hearts are hardened towards others can change and must change. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
As the song ended, Nuri Chavarria stepped outside the church and waved to the crowd from behind a chain-link fence. She thanked them for their support.
This is Nuri.
Jesus Sanchez Morales is a leader of Unidad Latina en Acción, or Latinos United in Action, a New Haven-based human rights organization.
We come from indigenous communities. We believe that we have, you know, our ancestors thousands of years ago stepped on these very land. And just like that, we believe that we have the right to step on these very land that our ancestors stepped on thousands of years ago without the fear of persecution, without inhumane treatment. Nuri, we're with you 100%, and we're going to keep fighting until the end. And just like Alok said earlier, this is not the beginning, this is not the end, but this can be the beginning of a collective fight. You and I, all of us, we can start fighting to change this regime. So thank you very much.
That was Jesus Morales Sanchez of Unidad Latina en Acción and other supporters of Guatemalan immigrant Nuri Chavarria speaking at a New Haven rally on July 23rd. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about Chavarria's case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the first time in its 108-year history, the NAACP has issued a travel advisory for a U.S. state. On August 2nd, the Civil Rights Group's National Board adopted a travel advisory for Missouri that had earlier been approved by the state chapter. The advisory calls on people of color to exercise extreme caution when traveling in Missouri due to an increase in hate crimes and discrimination, as well as a Jim Crow-era law recently signed by the state's Republican governor, Eric Greitens. Among the issues cited that provoked the travel advisory were statistics from the Missouri Attorney General's office revealing that African Americans in Missouri are 75% more likely to be stopped by police and searched than are the state's Caucasian drivers. Also cited was the recent signing into law of Senate Bill 43 that would make it more difficult to sue a business for discrimination. The controversial measure, set to be enforced as of August 28th, was sponsored by Republican State Senator Gary Romijn, whose business is currently defending against a racial discrimination lawsuit. Your reporter spoke with Hillary O. Shelton, director of the NAACP Washington Bureau and senior vice president for advocacy and policy. Here he discusses the reasons behind the issuance of the Missouri Travel Advisory, the response thus far from state officials, and the goals of issuing the advisory.
The travel advisory is not limited to just black people. Certainly African Americans have taken the lion's share of many of the challenges, problems, and other concerns in Missouri. But the travel advisory also includes the LGBT community, other people of color, and even women, as a matter of fact, as we look at the challenges in Missouri. This is something that actually came out of the state conference from Missouri. They'd had a meeting about 2 weeks before the national convention when it was determined that the governor of Missouri would move a new piece of legislation and sign into law a bill that actually makes it easier for corporations, businesses, and other entities in Missouri to discriminate against racial and ethnic minorities, women, religious minorities, and others, including the LGBT community in Missouri, without any option for protection or compensation. It makes it easier for corporations to discriminate. But even prior to that, a number of concerns have been lifted up. I mean, many of your listeners, I'm sure, heard about what happened to Michael Brown just a couple years ago now, an 18-year-old African-American scheduled to begin college. 1 week before, he was killed by a police officer, unarmed, in Missouri, and, of course, all that ensued around that. But there are a number of other concerns that it affected in Missouri, St. Louis, and other places around the state. I mean, a driver pulling into Missouri for just a minute because he missed a turn, was pulled over by police, and ended up dead. Other concerns of African-American women actually seeing a higher number of homicides in the state of Missouri and beyond. The lack of protection for the LGBT community seemed to be something that was growing and creating problems. So when the governor decided to actually sign a bill into law just a few weeks ago that would actually eliminate protections for racial and ethnic minorities, including African Americans, of course, women, the LGBT community, and others, they knew that something needed to be done. And as hard as the NAACP had worked and stated, realized that Missouri had become a very dangerous place to be. And following the lead from the actual U.S. State Department that actually issues travel advisories when it finds that Americans could be endangered in some places, other places across the world, that to let people know that this is a very dangerous place to be. You should know the problems that have occurred and be very careful if you decide you're going to go into Missouri. Of course, we've always believed people should have travel freedom to go wherever you want to go, but also believing that wherever you go, you should be made aware of the challenges, the threats, and the and other concerns that may occur in the places that you're considering traveling, and decided that Missouri was on that list as well. That like other foreign countries, when we have these concerns, the country can actually request of the U.S. government really guidelines. What does it need to do to improve its conditions? What levels of adherence does it need to make sure that that it's aware of and begin to move to make the changes that will make things safer?
What about the response of
Missouri Governor Greitens. What has he responded at all to the NAACP and the concerns expressed in this travel advisory?
We've not heard one word from him speaking specifically to the issues around the travel advisory, and that's saddening as well. You can't begin to address a problem or begin to repair it if you don't first claim it, own it, and realize you need to do something about it. When we look at the data and the challenges and problems that the state of Missouri faces now, one thing that is very clear is something needs to be done. The homicide rate is too high. The unemployment rate is too high. The other issues and challenges of allowing things like concealed carry permits are one of the easiest things you can get in the state of Missouri that's of any legal concern. And beyond that, they have what's called stand-your-ground laws that makes it easier to get away with shooting and killing someone else. In essence, with all these things and so many other challenges going on, for the governor to stand silent when a nationally renowned organization like the NAACP and your own constituents throughout the state of Missouri vote unanimously that something needs to be done, and you're hearing nothing, concerns are raised. But is it our hope that with this action, the people of Missouri, those who are in the elected offices, and even those who simply have a voter registration card, will see the importance of moving and working together to address these problems?
That was Hillary O. Shelton, director of the NAACP Washington Bureau and senior vice president for advocacy and policy. Learn more about the NAACP Missouri Travel Advisory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPP in Athens, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Hep C, a new death row. When I left death row, little did I know that I was entering another, quieter, non-obvious death row. Here, I'm not speaking of Pennsylvania's draconian life sentences, what I've called slow death row. No, I mean death by medical neglect and a malicious form of malpractice by the DOC's failure to treat the deadly liver infection, hepatitis C. At our court hearing, December 2015, we learned of the DOC's secret protocol, which explicitly refused to even consider treating any prisoner unless and until a person had esophageal varices, or in English, bleeding from one's throat. A federal judge sitting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the Honorable Robert Mariani, looked at that protocol and twice declared it unconstitutional. For lawyers, jailhouse lawyers, and especially you, members of the National Lawyers Guild, this is your open door to bring law to the people, to save lives, not to mention health, and to make state DOC medical officials serve medical needs and not profit motives. I end on this note. Today, in Pennsylvania prisons, indeed, in this very prison, prisoners are still being turned away because DOC Medical continues to apply its malicious and unconstitutional, profit-driven protocol. Our work is not yet done. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. And when he fell, pummeled, kicked repeatedly in his face and head.
When he appeared in court for arraignment some hours later, his left eye looked more like a golf ball than an eyeball. Saliva ran down his chin, reflecting his broken jaw. Almost all of the men were beaten. And what of the women? They were driven to the banks of the Delaware River, where they heard cops arguing amongst themselves. One cop would say, "Let's rape them and throw them into the water." They were rerouted and driven to the nearby House of Correction, a county prison, to await trial. What happened to them on August 8th, the holistic rain of police gunfire, beatings, rape threats, and incarceration was nothing compared to what they faced in Philadelphia courtrooms, where they were denied their every right, including their alleged right of self-representation, beaten again when they refused to attend their own legal lynchings, and then the lynchpin, convictions, and common sentences before Judge Edwin Malmed of 30 to 100 years for third-degree murder? Malmed, during a phone call from me to the Frank Ford Show at WWDB FM radio, where the judge was a guest, answered the question of who killed the cop by saying, "I haven't the faintest idea." Nine people, nine men and women, nine MOVE members, and 30 to 100 years. Today, August 2017, marks 39 years in prison for MOVE members, of which seven survive. Merle and Phil Africa have returned to the source under what can only be called suspicious circumstances. Another fact, none of the imprisoned MOVE sisters had weapons charges. Eddie Africa was never convicted of any degree of murder. His charges? Attempted assault, I kid you not. MOVE members are in prison today because they were MOVE members, period. They're guilty of nothing except resistance to a racist, brutal, corrupt system. The same system that gave rise to mass incarceration on a scale that the world has never seen before. Their sentences are an abomination. Free Delbert, Eddie, Mike, Chuck, Janine, Janet, and Debbie Africa. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Gangsters in government. In a matter of days, the White House has gone through its latest purge. Gone are stalwarts of the GOP, men like journalist Sean Spicer and former Republican National Committee Chief Reince Priebus, Trump's former press secretary and chief of staff, respectively. Spicer contorted himself like a pretzel trying to please his boss, but his efforts only led to more and more humiliation. From snap hiring of a political neophyte and outsider to be his communications chief served as the unkindest cut, sending Spicer on his way. Priebus had his share of humiliation pie as the newest hire, with Trump's tacit approval, savaged him in the media. Trump needed no help in humiliating his AG, a man who left the safe seat in the Senate to grab a ride on the Trump train. At every speech in the last few days, Trump needled Attorney General Jeff Sessions, showing a mean streak made meaner by the acquisition of imperial power. Trump, who saw his repeal and replace efforts to abolish Obamacare go down in flames, has had a presidential temper tantrum, slashing and burning all whom he deems disloyal. He, like a drunken monarch, demands loyalty from all, while he grants loyalty to none. Like the empire he represents, his office is a site of palace intrigue, of upheaval, of dysfunction, of glory days gone by, never to rise again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs radio program produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The show is podcast at globalresearch.ca and airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. This week, as part of our 2017 summer series, we air audio from a conference in Winnipeg centered around the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was officially founded on April 4, 1949 in Washington, D.C. Headquartered in Brussels, Belgium, NATO is comprised of 29 member states, including Canada, the United States, and 27 European countries. Added to the list since the fall of the Berlin Wall, which marked the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, 13 new states have been added to the list of member states, 10 of which were former Warsaw Pact countries. In the popular imagination, NATO was conceived as a vanguard against aggression from the Soviet Union, so one might reasonably conclude that the time has come for NATO to disband. Clearly, NATO in the current era has either found a new role for itself or is continuing a role it had clandestinely served since its creation. The Winnipeg Conference, which took place roughly on the 68th anniversary of NATO's founding, made an effort to probe that agenda and put it in the context of larger economic and geopolitical currents. The morning lectures took place at the University of Manitoba. The special guest presenters at this conference were Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, Paul Kellogg, and Roger Annis. The event was sponsored by the University of Manitoba's Geopolitical Economy Research Group in association with Peace Alliance Winnipeg, the Manitoba Chair for Global Governance Studies, the University of Manitoba Institute for the Humanities, the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba, and the Department of Political Science at the University of Winnipeg. Radhika Desai, professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group, functioned as lead, organizer, and convener. She opened with a few remarks.
Of the Cold War, NATO deployments have proliferated. How can we make sense of this if we consider the fact that NATO was supposed to be the West's weapon, the West's chief response to the rise of communism? Communism does not exist, but NATO is more active than ever before. A second consideration I'd like to lay before you is that at the end of the Cold War, everybody thought we were the bipolar world had been transformed into a unipolar world. This too has come a cropper. Just like the expectation of the peace dividend, the expectation that we would live in a unipolar world no longer seems to obtain. On the contrary, what has happened is that since that time, as the West has continued to stagnate, experiencing low growth rates, which actually date back before the 2008 recession, on the other hand, various other countries have, particularly led by China, of course, China being far in the front of all the emerging economies, have continued to post relatively high growth rates, which means that they have begun to shift the center of gravity of the world economy away from the West for the first time since the beginnings of capitalism. This is very important also for one other reason. It represents a time when, for the first time in the history of capitalism, new countries emerging and spreading productive power worldwide is not something new. It has happened before many times. In my own writing, I have named 1870, when three powers, Germany, United States, and Japan, rose to challenge British supremacy as the world's first multipolar moment, which was then added to by the Soviet Revolution and so on and so forth. I don't want to go through all that epic tale at this point, but that in itself is not new. But what will be new if this trend continues, and there are a lot of reasons to believe it will continue, is that for the first time, colonized or semi-colonized countries of the world will be emerging as major centers of world production. I think this represents an important development. And so the post-Cold War period has not been, new Cold War, whatever you want to call it, period, has not been one of unipolarity, but rather of a accelerating transition towards multipolarity as the West declines and other countries emerge. finally, today's lectures should also be put in one other important context. As you know, even in the Obama years, but certainly since the end of the Obama administration and the inauguration of the Trump administration, it has been increasingly difficult to try and understand what is happening with, you know, Obama was supposed to pull back troops, and he has become a sort of a new president of American aggression, the drone president, etc., etc. So, and of course, with the Trump administration, we are seeing all sorts of extremely contradictory messages emanating from the White House. NATO is useless. On the other hand, allies have to spend more on NATO. We are going to, you know, that there was some indication during the campaign that the American administration was going to draw in its claws, but in fact, President Trump has increased the military budget very massively, as you know, in a historically significant fashion. So all these things also form the questions to which I think the three lectures that are being given today will give us some really interesting and useful answers.
Mahdi Nazemroya is a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, currently working out of the University of the Philippines. He is the author of The Globalization of NATO, a contributor at the Strategic Culture Foundation, Moscow, and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. The focus of his talk was NATO, from the Atlantic to the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
For years after the disbanding of the Soviet dominated Warsaw Pact and the collapse of the USSR, NATO was viewed as a relic of the Cold War. With the threat of a Soviet invasion from Eastern Europe against Western Europe, with that threat gone, NATO had lost its raison d'etre. This is the Soviet threat, the Red Menace, the Communists, whatever you'd like to, however way you want to talk about them. In 1991, something happens. Latent act happens, an unseen and unknowable in terms of people didn't realize what happened. NATO had been silently involved in major military operations in the Gulf War. The first NATO war is the Gulf War. How it happened was, informally, all NATO allies were involved and all NATO plans for war were utilized in Iraq. They used the Gulf War as a testing ground for NATO strategies against the Soviet Union Warsaw Pact. In fact, it would not have been possible without the structure of NATO being present, the interoperability. It would have never been. They used, for example, the Germans, all the tanks they got from East Germany after unification were used. They used the NATO strategies for fighting the Soviet tanks against Iraq. All of this, the entire resources of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was used, and on informal in planning circles, they said, wow, we can do much more with this alliance. So NATO had silently been involved in major military operations in the Gulf War. This brightened the eyes of the Pentagon, and they considered the future possibilities. What are the future possibilities? Yugoslavia, the Federal Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia. Disintegration and devolving Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia saw NATO conduct several military campaigns in the Eastern European region of the Balkans. This was the first time that it was formal, and they used humanitarian grounds. And this was offensive. It's not defensive. The mandate has changed. If you attack us, we all will react collectively, but the mandate now changed. We get involved for humanitarian context. It intervened militarily in Bosnia in 1995. Next, it waged an aerial war over the fate of the predominantly Albanian-inhabited Serbian province of Kosovo against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which is a smaller Yugoslavia. It's Serbian Montenegro. Later, it changes its name to that. In 2001, NATO boots were deployed on the soil of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which NATO's Kosovo Liberation Army allies had been destabilizing. The events in the Balkans during the 1990s would be followed by the U.S.-led invasion of Taliban-controlled Afghanistan in the same year as the NATO deployment into Macedonia. NATO agreed to support the U.S. in the global war on terror under Article 5. The collective defense article of the treaty was invoked in 2001. So terrorism now comes into the fold. Then anti-piracy operations, maritime security comes into the fold. The mandate of this treaty, of this organization, is outside of the treaty, the legal parameters of the treaty. So NATO launched a policing mission to control the Mediterranean Sea called Operation Active Endeavor. And this is the first time that NATO's zone of operations expands officially the entire Mediterranean. The Eastern Mediterranean is now included. It goes on. The International Security Assistance Force goes 2003 into Afghanistan. This allows British and American troops to go to Iraq. What happens is your allies come in, take your place under whatever auspices you want to say, peacekeeping or as belligerents. They're both belligerents, if you ask me, in Afghanistan. And what happens is you're free to go attack Iraq. That's what Canada, by the way, did. I know from the former government under John Chrétien, members of that government, the debate within that was for this. The public would not agree to, they believed that the public would not be happy if Canada went to Iraq. So what they did is they agreed with the Americans, we'll send troops to Afghanistan, you can send troops to Iraq. So that's how Canada is involved in these wars. In the 1990s, there was a continuous reference by U.S. policymakers and Pentagon officials to Islam and a coming conflict in the Islamic world. Secretary General at the time would actually go so far as to say that Islam had become NATO's newest concern or threat. The military planners of the Pentagon and NATO also began contemplating in the 1990s, after the Cold War, missions to places in Africa like Somalia, Rwanda, and Congo. And in fact, they do go to Somalia. There's a NATO mission in Somalia. There's a NATO mission in Sudan, which you might not be aware about. It's NATO that directs and orders the African Union troops in both these countries. By 2001 onward, if it had not been already apparent in the late 1990s, it was clear that NATO was no longer just a defensive pact intended for mutual defense. It was operating in more than five different regions of the world, from the valleys of Afghanistan to the skies of East Africa and the waters of the coasts of Cuba and Greenland. The post-Cold War NATO is actively pursuing combat missions and international policing duties of airspace and international waters. NATO is publicly taking on itself to impose what its political leaders have claimed to be the maintenance of international law and stability, and a new mandate also for energy security. In 2006, 2007, in the Baltic states, there was a big conference, and energy security was discussed. And in fact, what was said there is if a country does not provide energy, it threatens our energy security. The country is being designated as a military threat for not giving its resources. That is the new norm that was starting to be established or legitimized. I should say during the Cold War, the U.S. had a network of Cold War alliances. NATO is the one I'm talking about, but there's also CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, MITO, the Middle East Treaty Organization, CENTO. It later evolves into the Central Treaty Organization. And then there was the Australia-New Zealand-United States Security Treaty, which broke up into two bilateral treaties because of New Zealand's refusal to allow nuclear weapons on its territory, which was, I mean, a very good thing on the part of the government in New Zealand. What this did is, and I will touch on it later, is it creates a chain of alliances around Russia, the Soviet Union, and China. There is a chain of alliances encircling them. NATO is on the far west of the Eurasian landmass. CENTO was in the center, and in the east was the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, CETO. Britain is a member of all three of these military alliances. France is a member of two. Turkey, Pakistan is part of CETO and the Middle East Treaty Organization. Turkey is part of NATO and CENTO. So you can see that this belt is created. You go to war with one of these countries, it ignites a response from the other alliances. So the United States and these organizations, whether it's by design or not, what it essentially does is it creates three military fronts that would light up at the same time because of joint memberships. I'm talking about NATO in terms of its world presence. So the term globalization, this mystified or changing term, as Radhika put it the other night, the goalposts change, which is absolutely correct. I think we have to take a look at it because it's part of the picture. The term comes first into use in 1944, but why I want to look at the term is it's tied to U.S. foreign policy and the idea of a borderless world as agreed upon in the Atlantic Charter in 1941. That's why I'm using that term. The United States and Britain off the coast of Newfoundland had a meeting. The Atlantic Charter was created. It talks about a borderless world. What essentially that means is U.S. corporations can go anywhere they want in the world. That was more or less the agreement. The borderless world meant that European empires, Western European empires to be precise, had to dismantle their empires. Why? Well, an empire, first of all, is a state of some sort, and there's preferential trade agreements. I mean, Britain and its colonies, it's internal, the trade, more or less, or France and its colonies. Once you dismember this empire, then there can never be between this core, this mother country, whatever you'd however way you want to describe it, there can't be that type of preferential trade. So it allows American corporations to move in. These were the agreements, basically Britain. It's a concession on the part of Britain, but it's also talking about a redesigned world. When a country becomes a NATO member, it has to, first of all, be joined something that's called, it has to become a partner first. It doesn't get full entry. It needs to, it is put on a more or less, it has to prove that it's ready to join. Under those conditions, there has to be economic reforms. There has to be, the military budget has to be transparent. They want to know what the military budget is. If you want to work with NATO, you have to have a transparent military budget. There's a reason for that. They want to see how you spend your expenditures, where it's going to. There's a business aspect, there's a security aspect to that. So these things come into play. I'll skip that. This organization, Association of Southeastern Asian Nations, was promoted by the United States, just like the European Union was also promoted. The U.S. position is that the European Union expands the influence of the United States. It expands the Euro-Atlantic zone. The American, Washington's position is also that ASEAN can expand U.S. influence in Southeast Asia. And if you look at what U.S. policy planners, strategic planners talk about, is they talk about we need bases, footholds in Asia and Europe. This is one of their footholds, an important entry point for encirclement. This is why ASEAN and CETO more or less come about at the same time. This started off as a community like the European Union, but there is a linkage between the expansion of the European Union and NATO. If you look, actually, NATO expansion comes always first, then European Union. It's the same here. What role do Sino-U.S. relations play in defining the Asia-Pacific regions? What role do they play in ASEAN? What about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Let me say, the head of China asserted in 1991 that a new Cold War, the word war is there twice, had begun between the United States and China. He said the Cold War between Moscow and Washington's over. The Cold War is now a new phase. It's between us and the United States. For the U.S., in the words of Brzezinski, China is unfinished business. So the Chinese, what's happening in the Asia Pacific, and it includes NATO, is they are trying to cordon off and encircle China. They're continuing the policy from the Cold War. It's in a new phase. It's being reorganized, re-merchandised, if you will, represented. It's a new face to what's happening. And this is part of the, Brazil maybe is now no longer there, but it's part of this push against these BRICS countries that are now becoming centers in their own right. It's against concepts like the Eurasian Economic Union. I'll move on. Or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Or the new Silk Road, or Silk Roads. And NATO is playing a role in de-dollarization. These countries that are outside of the orbit of the United States have agreements with each other to make Iran and Russia, China and Russia. They use each other's currencies. That includes the ALBA countries. So the Asia Pacific is being remilitarized. Japan no longer follows it. It's in blatant breach of its constitution. It's also even talking about nuclear weapons. Australia and New Zealand are back with the United States. New Zealand now will allow U.S. nuclear weapons on its soil. And more or less, NATO is being helped, is helping create a de facto CETO. What happened is, when there was a Sino-Soviet split, when Beijing and Moscow had problems, Beijing and the United States, to different degrees, worked together. And this, the United States no longer prioritized CETO, and it became defunct. Now it can't rebuild CETO. It wants to rebuild this military grouping, but it's tying it into NATO. So the pivot to the Asia Pacific, as Hillary Clinton announced in the foreign policy, it's not new. It's very old. It starts with the United States makes an agreement with Japan. You take Korea, we'll take the Philippines. This is an agreement between the State Department and Japan. You recognize us in the Philippines, we recognize you in Korea. They've been pivoting there since decades. It's not new at all. South China Sea, let's focus on it, and the East China Sea. The Chinese, to justify what's happening, the Chinese are being portrayed as antagonists, violators, aggressive. It's not true. If you look at China after the Cold War, it's the country that's actually given up the most territory. It's given up territory to Vietnam, even though there's a dispute between the two. It's actually been very calm and relaxed on a lot of issues. I'm not here to say China's a bed of roses, but in reality, what's happening is China is being demonized to justify U.S. military position there and the encirclement of the People's Republic of China. The geopolitical strategy of the U.S. is it's a classical sea power versus land power. It includes incorporation, it includes restructuring regions and people. It comes from the ideas of Mackinder. So Mackinder talks about the heartland. It's about controlling the heartland, and if you control the heartland, you control the world island. The world island is Eurasia, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And he says if you control it, U.S. strategists don't subscribe to this. They believe in more the rimland is the way to control the heartland. And they see Eastern Europe is falling in, Western Europe falling into the rimland. And that's the strategy that comes about through Nicholas Spikeman. You can see the rimland there, and that's where most American bases are located. It's in that area. Those three military alliances are there. China and Russia, well, China's in the rimland as well, but that heartland is where Russia and China are. I just want to quote Spikeman. Any proposal for the unification of Europe would tend to put Europe in a subordinate position to Germany, regardless of the legal provisions of the agreement. Since Germany, unless broken up into fragments, will still be the biggest nation of the continent. This is another quote. The most important single fact in the American security situation is the question of who controls the rimlands of Europe and Asia. Should these get into the hands of a single power or combination of powers hostile to the United States, the resulting encirclement would put us in a position of grave peril, regardless of the size of our army and navy. The reality of this threat has been dimly realized in the past. On the two recent occasions when a single power threatened to gain control of the European mainland, we have become involved in a war to stop it. But our efforts have been belated and have been carried out at huge cost to ourselves. Had we been fully conscious of the implications of our geographical location in the world, we might have adopted a foreign policy which would have helped to prevent the threat from arising in the first place. This is after the Cold War. After World War II. These statements are towards the end and after World War II. What this is saying is we cannot provide any dominant power. And our policy has to openly try to keep everybody weak. It's an adoption of British policy in Europe. The British policy is keep the Continentals weak. That was it, and the Americans inherit this. I also want to prove a point. The word CENTO means Central Treaty Organization. It's been established. I think that should be clear. Guess what? The United States has a military command, geographic command, which it also calls United States Central Command. Why does it call it United States Central Command? This proves that even CENTO, the naming, the organizing of it, it's from the Washington Beltway. It's from an American perspective. Because that is the central front for the United States in the encirclement of Eurasia. NATO is the Western front. and Sito was in the Eastern Front. And for them, that's the Central Front. We should not forget the global events. They're tied to one another. For example, the coup in Caracas in Venezuela in 2002, one of the main purposes was they wanted cheap Venezuelan oil ready when Iraqi output was out. That's the official position of the Venezuelan government based on U.S. documents. Hugo Chavez himself readily says this. They wanted to take our country in 2002 because they were ready to attack Iraq and they wanted our oil, cheap oil. The price of oil would have risen and they also needed, they wanted to use our oil for the war. So you might look at places like Ukraine, you might look at places like Syria. Do not think that these are all separate. There is a linkage. In fact, in Ukraine, people that are tied to Chechen separatists who used to fight the Russians in the 1990s, who are now fighting in Iraq and Syria under the banners of ISIL, they're also fighting in Ukraine on the side of the Ukrainian National Guard. So these people who are supposedly jihadists, who want to kill Christians and Jews and Shiite Muslims, it's very odd that they're bedfellows. It's not impossible, but they're bedfellows with the National Guard in Ukraine. So the discourse, there's a discourse that's communicating a wrong message, and that's why we're talking more about fake news nowadays. The discourse is there to justify policies of demonization and otherization, and a clash of civilizations is also part of this discourse, I think. It's trying to say, for example, Samuel Huntington's political project says that the Cold War was a civil war in the West. That's how he says it in his book. The Cold War is a civil war in Western civilization. Yet, a few pages down, he says Russia is not part of Western civilization. How can it be a civil war in the West, and yet Russia is not a part of Western civilization? Russia, whenever Russia is targeted, it's presented as this Asiatic country, non-European country. And this is part of the process, to say it's part of this Orthodox civilization, to say that there's a cynic. I mean, there are differences, but I think that from my personal standpoint, whether you agree or not, there's a human civilization. I don't adhere to this model which just puts Latin America arbitrarily there for outside of West or Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, without even knowing the diversities. But these type of models are being presented, cultural models, saying, for example, trying to put Ukraine and Russia on different cultural boundaries. I think more or less economic dimensions, we can't ignore the economic dimensions which the previous speaker brought about, but we also rivalries, the military dimensions, and we can't ignore the discourse of justification for free markets. I mean, it's putting the world on the brink of what could potentially be very dangerous. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in the last few years has given the highest, they say it's more it's closer to midnight than most of the Cold War. And we're not aware of these things. We should be aware of these things. What's happening in the demonization of the Chinese and Russians, as well as others, including Venezuela, you have to understand the processes behind this. You have to reflect on them. Nobody's saying that there's any, it's black and white, but you do need to reflect on these issues, and you need to ask yourself, why is Canada in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has a defensive mandate, when they're no longer, is a threat? Even the documents of the NATO's stop using the word threat after, or danger after the Cold War. What, this is something as Canadians we need to ask ourselves. We need to, it's something people of respectable conscience need to ask themselves also. So without any more ado, thank you.
That was Mahdi Nazemroya speaking at last April's Winnipeg conference on the dangers of NATO in the post-Cold War era. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour 2017 summer series, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also podcast and available for download on the website globalresearch.ca. My name is Michael Welch. On this week's program, we are airing audio from a conference on the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era, held on April 3, 2017, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Paul Kellogg is an associate professor in the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies at Athabasca University and writes extensively about Canada and international political economy, Marxist theory, and social movements. His most recent book is entitled Escape from the Staple Trap, Canadian Political Economy After Left Nationalism, published by University of Toronto Press. His talk was focused on the political economy of the current period of militarism and was entitled Addicted to War, the Corporate Foundation of U.S. Militarism.
The difference between what the U.S. government spends on arms and every other state in the world is incredible. That's the first point that I want to make. Why do I say this is abnormal? Because while the U.S. has just 5% of the world's population, the arms spending that I've documented here represents almost half of the world's totals. Other states don't do this on this scale. It's interesting to me that in the 1990s, when defense spending was lower, this is a chart of battle-related deaths going back to 1989 to 2010, the 1990s were a worse decade for battle-related deaths than the first decade of the 21st century. It's not driven by a massive you don't have a massive upward spike in battlefield deaths and therefore a massive upward spike in military spending. It's happening for other reasons. We have to turn to arms spending as economics. I do not believe that arms spending is primarily driven by military policy. I believe it's primarily driven by as economics. There's a long story here that's extremely interesting. The first couple of years after World War II were economically very difficult, as millions and tens of millions of soldiers were demobilized, as arms spending was ratcheted down. There was recessions and problems in many, many countries around the world, including the United States, including Canada. 46 to 47 were very, very difficult years. They stumbled into a solution. The Korean, what is called, euphemistically called the Korean War, which really should be called the War of U.S. against China, because the principal fight was between the United States and China, led to a stop to the whole demilitarization of the United States, a remilitarization, a return to arms spending, and the economy stabilized. And there was a very interesting, this correlation was noticed by a whole lot of people, that if we can be the world's big military power, we can have, there's lots of benefits that go with that. We're able to intervene into Latin America, we're able to keep the world safe for capitalism, and it also stabilizes the economy. John Maynard Keynes was one of the great economists of the 20th century, and he knew that capitalism by itself could not sustain, was crisis prone. Capitalism left, the market left to itself keeps getting you into crisis over and over and over again. He knew that states had to intervene into the economy in order to smooth out the ups and downs of the market cycle. And he was in despair towards the end of his life because he'd come to the conclusion that the ideologically driven people who were running the system in the capitalist states were ideologically completely opposed to state intervention, except when it came for warfare. And he, looking ahead, said, I am worried that we're going to get state intervention, but the only state intervention that's going to be allowed ideologically is military state intervention. In the case of the United States, he was completely right. Military Keynesianism was the result, priming the economy with arms spending, something feared by Keynes before his death. Problem. Military Keynesianism, while it does lead to economic growth, it leads to distorted economic growth. That's the next point I want to make. Remember the F-35. People know about this thing? This is the big jet that we're all supposed to buy. And it's going to... Who's Canada going to be fighting? I can't remember. It doesn't matter. It's like, that's the big jet that is being promoted as the next billion-dollar toy for the military-industrial complex. This is a map. The areas in green are areas of production and training for the F-35. Look at where they're situated. They're situated in the south and the west of the United States. Paul Koistinen, who's the author of a book called, a series of volumes called The Political Economy of American Warfare, calls this the Gun Belt. And he's saying, now we know of this as the Gun Belt for other reasons. We know that this is the Gun Belt because this is the place which deifies the right to carry arms and the Second Amendment and all that type of thing. The point he's making, it's a gun belt for other reasons, because there has been massive industrial development in the southwest of the United States, and it is driven by the Pentagon. It's driven by military production, and it doesn't come without a cost. Another little footnote. It's kind of strange what I'm talking about, because the United States as a state has a reputation as a polity that does not believe in industrial policy. The Europeans, they do industrial policy. They give subsidies to industry. America, we're the free market. You know, we let the free market rule. In fact, what Paul Coynston and others say is that the Pentagon directing billions of dollars of spending towards industry is actually a massive industrial policy. There is an industrial policy in the United States. There is a state intervention into the economy to stimulate industry. The chosen industry to stimulate is the building of nuclear submarines, nuclear jet planes, and all the rest of it. The creation of that gun belt, Paul Coynston makes the case, he says, goes in parallel to the creation of the Rust Belt, which we're more familiar with in the northeast of the United States. Cleveland and Buffalo, Detroit, Chicago, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, that area which was the core of the old civilian industries, the old civilian manufacturing base, which has gone into a long decline over many years. One last point. This is corporately driven. This is driven not by, not solely by state policy, although there's a lot of state policy involved. There's deeply embedded corporate interests at the heart of this. The SIPRI database keeps a list of the top 100 arms corporations in terms of annual arms sales. This is all adjusted for inflation in the world, excluding China. If you go back to 2002, that amounted to $290 billion of sales a year. It's gone up to $396 billion by 2015. The share of the United States of that was 61% in 88, 63.9% in 2002, 60% of sales from the top 100 corporations are based in the United States. I put Europe down there as a comparator just to take a look at it. It's about half the rate of the United States. But in terms of profits, the profit share that goes to the top 100 U.S. corporations is enormous. It's higher than the share of, in other words, these are extremely profitable corporations, extremely profitable activities for these top 100 corporations to engage in. In 2002, the year after the beginning of the war on, or what's called the war on terror, the war on Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, you can see the frenzy of spending that happens that leads to massive profits. 97.4% of the profits that year go to those top 100 U.S. corporations. It's a hugely profitable industry to get into. There's one last way of looking at this. These top 100 corporations are not simply involved in the production of arms, they're increasingly dependent upon them. Three clusters of years, 1988 on the left, 2002 in the middle, 2015. This is looking at the extent to which the corporations in the world as a whole, in the United States and Europe, are dependent on arms sales for their sales. You go back a generation to 1988, it's about 15-16%. You go to 2002, it's up to 20%. In our area, it's skyrocketed to more than a third. Increasingly, these corporations are dependent upon arms sales. They're embedded. It's like a drug addict who needs a bigger and bigger hit to get the same high, if you want to think of it that way. So that's the drug addict. You go back here, that's the effect. The effect of it is to hollow out whole areas of the country to make the country sick. I'm going to pull it to a close. I've got lots of other ways of looking at it. If you want a list of all the corporations in the U.S. that are involved in this, the big one is Lockheed Martin, there's Raytheon, Northrop Grumman. You can ask me about them in discussion. If you want to take a look at specifics, Lockheed Martin is the one that was made famous by Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine. Everything he said about it is true. It's by 2011, only 1% of its production was for civilian uses. Everything else goes to the military. Think of Boeing Corporation. We love Boeing. Don't we love Boeing? It's the Dreamliner. The Dreamliner that's going to take us places. And the Boeing 747, that big jumbo jet, it's a wonderful corporation. Half of Boeing Corporation's sales are embedded in the military. It used to be about 20%, it's now half. It is a military corporation, it is dependent on the military. How do we conclude this? Because I should bring it to a close. This is the tip of the iceberg. The most important industry in the world is the oil industry. I haven't even factored this into the whole thing. The biggest consumer of oil in the world is the U.S. military. That has to be thought of as an embedded part of the corporate militarism that I'm talking about. How one would do that would be a research project that would be complicated, but it could be done. The form of an organization like NATO is as a military alliance. NATO presents itself as a military alliance, which it is, but it is more than that. It is also the legitimate face of corporate state militarism. It legitimizes the processes behind here, which are not really driven by the security needs of states, but are driven by the corporate needs of corporate capitalism. Corporate state militarism is inherently unstable. While it benefits U.S. corporations in the short term, in the long term, it undermines the political and economic environment in which they operate. I've talked about the distortion of public finances. I've talked about the skewing of industrial policy away from civilian production towards arms production. There are other bigger problems, which I'm going to look at in the presentation in the evening. Corporate state militarism is dangerous. The economic logic of the warfare states puts us constantly at risk of the guns being actually used. And we all know that. That's one I don't need to embellish very much. Corporate state militarism cannot be challenged piecemeal. Our new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, presents himself as a 21st century kind of guy. You know, he's in sync with all of the modern, progressive, hip things that go on. And he sanctioned the $15 billion sale of military equipment to Saudi Arabia. That puts him in bed with the entire logic of corporate militarism, corporate state militarism that I've talked about here. He's a hip guy, you know. Because it's 2015 was his answer to why he was doing things in terms of 50, you know, because it's 2015. Well, because it was 2015, is that why he is so for the Keystone XL pipeline? And what will the Keystone XL pipeline do? It embeds the Canadian oil industry in the logic of corporate state militarism for the reason that I've talked about, I referred to, biggest user of oil in the world, biggest single user is the American military machine. Trudeau is feeding this with his... You can't have it both ways. You can't both be a progressive person in words and a reactionary in your actions. And these two actions, the arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the agreement to the Keystone XL, are reactionary in themselves and interestingly in sync with the corporate logic of militarism that I have outlined earlier. So, the conclusion, once again, is quite simple. We have to oppose this corporate state militarism, which is at the center of world capitalism. And to oppose it, you have to also combat the capitalism itself. You can't choose to just do one without the other. The two logics are completely in sync like this. It's daunting, but it's the only conclusion that I can come to from looking at this research. And that's it.
No stranger to regular Global Research NewsHour listeners, Roger Annis is a longtime socialist and retired aerospace worker based in Vancouver. He writes regularly on topics related to peace and social justice, and in particular, he has written extensively on Canada's involvement in Haiti and more recently in Ukraine. He's the founding editor of the newcoldwar.org website. The focus of his talk was Post-Cold War NATO, Why Conflict Continues and the Prospects for Peace.
Now, I don't have to tell you that we live in a dangerous world. It's a world of deepening war and militarism, and my two previous colleagues have given you quite a view of that, and just how deep and fundamental a problem that is to the world system that we have. We live in a world of permanent war, and if we don't take steps to end this world of permanent war, it's going to get a lot worse. Certainly what's at stake in the NATO conflict against Russia,
sparked by events in Ukraine, and that's how I describe what's gone on in the past 3 years. What's at stake there is nothing less than the danger of nuclear war. But there's two other major dangers that we face in the world that we have to take into account when we look at NATO in particular and the whole world, as I think Mahdi has shown us well. When we talk of NATO, we're not simply talking about Europe. One are the growing social and economic inequalities in the world, which are worsening. Doesn't mean everybody's getting poorer, but on a relative scale, the majority of the world is getting worse off, not better. And then the third grave danger we face is, of course, an out-of-control global warming emergency. And we really need to have the three of these put together in a common view of the world in order to understand where we're going and what needs to be done to reverse course and put us on the path towards a world of social equality, but also a world in which we care for the environment and we care for the ecology. We don't regard the environment as some endless storehouse that we can simply go in and steal from and wreck and destroy and not consider what that means for future generations. Why are we facing these incessant wars that are only deepening? Well, it has to do with the economic imperatives of the major imperialist countries that control the world and which are each one of them led by their own wealthy class of capitalists who own the banks and the industrial corporations and all the rest. And Canada is a member of NATO, a fully fledged member of NATO, and one of the top economic powers of the world, is very much part of this. It's NATO's and all of these imperialist countries' relentless drive to grab as much as they can of the wealth that is generated by the labor of ordinary human beings and the natural resources that lay there in the ground, in the water, and in the earth. But they run into a problem in this, which is the resistance of ordinary people to all of this exploitation and despoliation. It's called, Marxists call it the class struggle. And that's, you know, a term to use simply, or a term to describe the natural inclination of human beings to come together and take care of one another. And so when we work for a company that wants to pay us pitiful wages, or if we're in the third world, we're not even getting paid enough to put food on our table, well, of course, there's a natural inclination for us to come together as human beings, form trade unions, form student associations, form farmers' organizations, to strengthen our First Nations governing institutions and organizations to fight against them. And this is the driving force of history. This is what Karl Marx wrote in and Frederick Engels wrote in their path-breaking works. A class struggle is the driving force of history. And what they mean by that simply is human beings want to live in a fair and just world, and we will come together and fight to achieve that. And that's a great thing, because without it, we'd be slaves still. We'd be serfs still. We've advanced, but we haven't advanced all the way that we need to. So NATO symbolizes all of these ills because it's the mechanism, it's the military mechanism by which they enforce their rule. That's what armies do, and that's what police forces do. They enforce the inequalities of society. So worse than blocking progress, NATO is worsening the situation in the world. And I don't need to remind you of the destruction of Libya, literally the destruction of a country. Yemen, the near destruction of Syria, though I believe the Syrian people have turned the corner on that. Afghanistan, again, we're talking destructions of entire societies and countries, not wars that have killed some people. All of these terribly destructive wars. Well, I mean, to understand this, we really have to go back to the wreckage of 1945. 1945 was a world of complete destruction. And the capitalists couldn't go on ruling the world like this anymore. They nearly lost the world. They lost a third of the world. There was a revolution in 1917 in Russia that opened what is still... We live in the era of socialist revolution, where that possibility of making a societal leap towards a society of equality and justice exists. And the Russian Revolution, and most certainly in its earliest years, but even in its later years, set a model. And then there was the incredible revolution in China, which succeeded in 1949, which opened the door to the decolonization of the entire world. But this is the most important thing. Well, apart from the social development of China itself, the Chinese Revolution opened the door to the decolonization of the entire world. You had anti-capitalist revolutions in Eastern Europe, And then not so much later after World War II in Korea, in Vietnam, in 1959 in Cuba, and many, many other countries of the world that attempted to get this capitalist system off their backs. And because of these revolutions that were all in the third world countries, the capitalists had to make significant concessions to workers and to young people and to not so much the First Nations people. That came later through struggle, but the welfare state was born as a way of buying off social revolution, because if the capitalists didn't concede the welfare state, then they were going to have revolutions like Russia's and like China's, and they knew that, so they had to do it. So what the capitalists, the only thing they could do in 1945 was to begin to assemble the apparatus to contain this, contain their losses, prevent the further social revolutions from taking place. And they did so with force and violence. Even in the developed capitalist countries in Western Europe, where countries like Italy and France were kind of on the edge of carrying through a social revolution that would kind of resemble what they saw happening in Eastern Europe. But certainly in the Third World, where they faced challenges all over the Third World, and they lost many of those challenges after World War II. But that was their goal, was containment. And that was what NATO was about, was containing the example and the achievement that had been won by the Soviet people. And when I say the Soviet people, I don't mean just the Russian people. I mean the Ukrainian people, the Georgian people, this multinational entity that became the Soviet Union, and that accomplished great things socially and economically, even before World War II, but certainly following it. And so it was a strategy of containment, biding time, and essentially trying to starve into submission these countries. That's what the Cold War was about. I mean, they literally embargoed the Soviet Union, but they also tried to cripple it with the arms race and with all of the other forms of economic competition that the Soviet Union was obliged to respond to. The Soviet Union didn't go out and try and equal the United States in armaments because, you know, it had some inherent interest in an arms industry the way that Paul has described the United States did. No, it was simple self-defense. If they didn't do it, they'd be destroyed. I think there's a lot of, in my view, the events in Ukraine in particular spark a need, an understanding of the need for much deeper analysis of what's gone on in the world. Why did the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China not continue? What did Russia, the new Russia and the new China, what did they become? Even though they're capitalist countries, you know, a recent study said Russia is one of the most unequal countries in the world. That is the gap between rich and poor. Proportionally, we're not talking about money. I mean, by far the most unequal country in the world is just south, in the world, it's just south of the border. But it's a capitalist country. Russia has a lot of responsibility for the global warming emergency because it's the biggest combined oil and gas producer in the world. But nonetheless, here are capitalist countries because they don't have the same imperialist dynamic towards expansion. Endless expansion. Russia would be quite happy just to be left on its own. It's got more than enough problems in its national space and in its periphery to solve. It doesn't need the oil of Syria. It doesn't need the plantations of Africa and so on. Does that mean that Russia is like a new socialist country or something? Or that the people of Russia can just kind of go to bed and not worry about all the poverty that's there? It's become a different world in the past 25 years, and we have capitalist countries that are emerging that have the capacity to stand up to the United States. And when they do that, they create space for people like you and I to survive. Look what happened in Crimea. Barely a loss of life that Crimea was able to get out of this threatened right-wing government by Kiev. By contrast, in the Donbass area of eastern Ukraine alone, the civil war in the last 3 years, has caused more than 10,000 deaths, and we had the most recent figures from a study in Germany. 3 million people displaced from the regions of Donetsk and Lugansk in eastern Ukraine. It's called Donbass. It's a historic area that's largely Russian-speaking. Contrast the two. Crimea has incredible economic prospects ahead of it. They're building a bridge across the Kerch Strait, and on. I mean, compared to the stagnation that it lived. So that's just one example. My thoughts on what we need to do in this country to be building a new anti-war movement, or a renewal of an anti-war movement, which, by the way, has accomplished a great deal. When you see the Canadian government going around today, not able, for example, to fulfill its commitment to intervene militarily in Africa with a 600-member force that it wants to intervene. It said so. It said so since the Trudeau government has said so since last year. What's the problem? Well, because we have a lot of things that have been achieved over the last 15 years, and particularly through the anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Iraq in 2003. So we're building upon what we've already accomplished. But, you know, we need to be back in the streets in our hundreds and thousands to really affect the course of events. Now, it doesn't mean we're all going to, you know, we're going to go out and form, you know, anti-war groups tomorrow that I would have, you know, a platform like that. These are, you know, these are complicated issues, and they've been divisive because we haven't paid attention as a progressive movement. Our trade unions, our student organizations, our First Nation people, we haven't been discussing what's going on in the world and how it affects us, and we need to. So I'm not suggesting, you know, in every city in Canada, people are going to agree readily we have to go out and form a coalition to oppose Canadian intervention in Ukraine. I'd like to have that happen. We should be demanding that there be no Canadian troops in Ukraine, that Ukraine not become a member of NATO. And in fact, we should return to the historic demand of the left movement in Canada, which is Canada of NATO. It used to be a plank in the platform of the New Democratic Party, and they tossed it aside 10 years ago. So, I mean, this could be the platform of the NDP, and we should be fighting for that. But from my standpoint, if the most successful fight that we can have to win progressive society in Canada, and I'm talking, you know, the members of the NDP, the members of the Green Party, the members of trade unions, the best thing I think we could be doing is forming a new party of the political left, a genuinely left and socialist party, which would have a very cooperative attitude and relationship towards the NDP and towards all of the other social and political organizations in the country. Because these are complicated issues, and they can't be solved by a group of us sitting around as a coalition. I mean, this requires political leadership and experience. We need to run in elections on a platform like this, or at least that's the anti-war plan. And then hear what Canadian people have to say, because we'll learn from them as they will learn from us. So, but I think that that's the course that we need to go on. We have a situation right now where there's only one thing that stands in the way of the Canadian government getting more deeply into NATO's war offensive, which is this legacy that we've established. We fought wars in the past. We fought for women's equality, and that's not something you can take easily away. First Nations people today are making gains in progress in achieving their sovereignty and their rights, against police violence, all of the social ills that we have quite a good track record of achieving this. But this has to cohere into politics, because we don't have a party in Parliament right now that speaks on these issues. So on this anti-war front, this narrow anti-war front, you know, these are the ideas that I think we need to be discussing, and I hope we could readily agree on these. I think they're pretty important, pretty basic and straightforward, but, you know, we need the discussion, because all of these things are complicated. But I hope that that's the path that we're embarked on increasingly. This conference today and tonight is an important part of that, and I'll continue to be part of that, and I look forward to all of your views on that as we go through the conference today and in the weeks and months and several years ahead. So thanks for your attention.
You've been listening to some of the audio from a conference on the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era. The speakers included moderator Radhika Desai of the University of Manitoba, Paul Kellogg of Athabasca University, Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, author of The Globalization of NATO, and Roger Annis, writer and founding editor of newcoldwar.org. Unabridged versions of all three talks, along with video, as well as a follow-up roundtable, can be found at the website geopoliticaleconomy.org. The events were recorded by Winnipeg-based videographer Paul Graham, and his YouTube channel is Paul S. Graham. Music this week was provided by Purple Planet Music. More of their music can be found at www.purple-planet.com. This has been the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our shows on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Our programs are available for download at globalresearch.ca. To send your feedback on this or any of our other programs, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will return with new programs in September. Thank you for joining us. My name is Michael Welch. Please stay tuned for your next regularly scheduled program.